Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on February the 15th of 2017. It's Y-Rod here alongside Rolo T, set to continue our bizarre Pokemon adventure. How you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well, Nick. I'm a little, I don't know what the verb would be for feeling injustice. I'm injusticed. But I've always held a deep respect for the Pokemon universe. I've always had a lot of treasured memories with it. But upon looking up a pronunciation guide for Pokemon names, I recently discovered it's not Scizor, it's Scizor.
Yeah.
And that's nonsense. That sounds ridiculous.
If they wanted it to be pronounced Scizor, it would stay like S-C-Y, like Scyther is.
But Scizor sounds lame. He sounds like a pair of scissors. Mm-hmm. And I get the obvious pun they're trying to go with there, but Scizor sounds cool. It would be like calling Magneto Magnet Man instead of Magneto. It's like, no, that's a cool-sounding name, not Magneto. Yeah.
Magneto is the master of magnet, after all, so...
Yeah, so I feel like I'm a little bit jaded with the Pokemon universe now. I was all high on it, and now I'm like, what, it's Scizor?
You feel betrayed by the pronunciation guy.
I do. I'm like, for all these years, I thought Scizor was a much cooler Pokemon. Turns out it's Scizor. You might as well have fucking glasses and a cowlick.
I disagree. I think that Scizor sounds way less lame than Scizor.
Oh, fuck you. You are? All right,
Scizor sounds like a Power Rangers villain.
That's why it's cool! When did Power Rangers villains stop being cool? I eagerly await the day we get Divatox the Pokemon.
I'm pretty sure it was Squattin' Babu.
I think that
was the killer.
They can't all be winners, but a couple of them will be.
All right. Well, we have a lot to talk about. The last time that we talked about Pokemon, we went on for like an hour. I'm going to try to make us not do it this time, but we should get started just to make sure that we've got the time to get through everything and to get through the recap, Portia League of Manga recap. So let's talk some Pokemon. We got Ruby and Sapphire chapter this week to talk about, continuing our regular going through JoJo and going through Pokemon one big arc at a time. And this one focuses on the third generation of Pokemon. It's actually one of three little arcs that go into it. The latter two we're going to cover in one chunk because basically I wanted us to, like I said when I first announced that we were going to do this, divide it into nice, easily readable chunks as opposed to, let's do all of Gen 3. That's like twice as long as the previous two generations. So... Ruby and Sapphire. You liked Ruby and Sapphire games, right? I think you talked about it.
It's my favorite gen.
Yeah.
Like, I go to Gen 3 most out of all of them. Like, even though Gen 1 probably holds the most nostalgia for me, I think Gen 3 is the one I enjoyed the most, and it's primarily because outside of the first gen, where I didn't know what Pokemon was at the time, I just bought a game and played it. Gen 3 was the only gen I didn't know about any of the Pokemon in it going into the game. It was essentially a blind thing. I just picked up Pokemon I liked, and then it was really awesome when, like, something like Aron evolved into, like, Laron. I was like, oh, I'll just pick up this thing. It's Rock Steel. It's kind of cool type. And I'm like, holy shit, it evolved into a metal rhinoceros! This is awesome! This is the greatest! So,
I fucking love the Aggron line. That little iron rhinoceros triceratops monster is badass.
It is extremely cool, and I just hold a lot of good memories to it. It's probably the game I played the most overall, and I think it's when, by and large, Pokemon was at its best. I understand it's a very subjective thing, and I'm not saying that a fact.
Everyone's gonna have a favorite generation. So. Yeah,
but I really loved a lot of the stuff that they did, and I really liked the new Pokemon they put into it, too. I wasn't crazy about Johto, but Ruby and Sapphire, almost all of them are big winners for me, except for Spoink. Spoink is stupid.
Spoink is weird.
It's a fucking pig head on a spring that if it stops bouncing, its heart stops. It's so dumb. It's ridiculous.
I don't know if you've ever seen the comic where, like, the character is like, oh, Spoink's so adorable, and just, like, picks up and hugs it, and then you get the Pokedex entry. If it stops bouncing, it dies. It's going...
It was really like one of those moments where it had to be like a bunch of people in like Game Freak office who were just like, So what do we do for the next Pokemon? We need like a psychic type, maybe like a two-stage kind of Pokemon. Like, we haven't done a pig Pokemon recently. We also haven't done a spring Pokemon recently. Can we maybe combine those two together? It's like,
Spoink doesn't bother me so much. Grumpig, I think, is stupid as fuck, though.
I don't mind Grumpig, because at least Grumpig makes sense as a Pokemon. Spoink, I'm like, what are you? You're just fun to, like, evolution should have wiped you out so long ago. Your only mode of transportation is stopped by rocky terrain, and you're found exclusively on a hill of rocks in fucking hot lava. It's ridiculous.
I remember getting really pissed off when I went through Gen 3 because if you don't choose Torchic as your starter, then it's like you're fucked for fire Pokemon until like halfway through the game.
Well, it's not that bad because you get to Fire Path and you can get a couple there. It's Gen 4 where if you didn't pick a fire Pokemon, it was like, hope you love Ponyta or nothing.
And then you get to like the ice gym at the 7th and it's like, I still don't have a fire type Pokemon. Oh, well. Fighting type works too.
That's my motto in every game. I'm like, psychic type.
Fighting type will do it.
Psychic type, better punch my way through this one. Psychic fairy type, this is gonna suck, but here we go.
Psychic fairies, whatever, I've got 400 attack on my Hitmonlee.
Yeah, I'm like, who cares? My Graveler knows a fighting type move, and he's gonna use that exclusively. He knows other moves.
Whatever.
He knows Brick Break.
Shut up, Alakazam, you fucking nerd. Punch.
That's all. I should become a Pokemon gym leader, and he just specializes in fighting types, and every time I beat someone up, I'm just like, fucking nerd, every time he beats a psychic type.
Your introduction as a gym leader is like, everyone thinks they've got a type advantage until they get punched in the face.
Until they get a fucking punch right in the kidney. Then what do you do, huh?
Then you command your Pokemon, and you're just like, ugh, please. You thought I was talking about punching your Pokemon in the kidney. Nope. No one thinks that. Everyone thinks I'm above punching a 10-year-old in the ribs, but I'm not.
Hey, they establish in this manga that the Pokemon League allows gym leaders to operate as they so fit. Some gym leaders are fine with, like, kids showing a good effort and giving them the badge. I am fine with punching children right in the face, throwing sand in their eyes, catching them while they're asleep at the Pokemon Center, and just sending my Hitmonchan to start punching the crap out of them while they're sleeping. Anything to get
right,
a win.
Kid. That's right, kid. Try commanding your Gengar now. Oh, that's right. You go to sleep. Yeah. Try having him eat your dreams, bitch.
Sweet dreams. Sweet dreams. Yeah, no one's getting my
banner. Undefeated!
Yeah, that's why my banner comes down.
Dancing on a mountain of 10-year-old kids.
My theme song starts playing, dancing on the ceiling. Oh, yeah, Kurt Angle. It's like, intensity, integrity, intelligence.
And like, I rock. I rock.
Oh, man.
Anyway, I've barely talked about this manga at fucking all. All right.
I'm going to keep us on point now, Nick.
Okay.
Did you ever notice how Roman Reigns, Nick?
So, one of the interesting things about this chapter of the manga is that it stays very true to the plot of the game as compared to the previous three stories that we've gotten with Red and Blue and then Yellow and then Gold and Silver and Crystal. Gold, Silver, and Crystal had to essentially invent a plot from fucking scratch because they were like, Team Rocket revived? No, nothing to do with that at all. Price is the villain. he did command a Team Rocket, whatever. But in this one, if you've played Ruby and Sapphire or Emerald, then you essentially know the major plot of the story, which is that Team Rocket is trying to revive Kyogre to expand the oceans. Team Magma is trying to revive Groudon to expand the land, and the two legendary Pokemon end up clashing against each other and causing worldwide cataclysms because they're these gigantic, these titanic Pokemon that both affect the weather and are ripping the world apart while everyone scrambles to try and stop them.
Hot take, Nick. Which side are you, Team Aqua or Team Magma?
I've always thought Groudon was cooler.
There you go. That's right. That's the correct opinion to have.
Kyogre's not bad, but I think that it's the least cool of those three, between the two of them and Rayquaza in terms of design. Plus, I do really appreciate that when they went to Omega, it was like, yeah, Groudon's Omega form actually just gets rid of water, so...
They're like, fuck you now.
Fuck you. You thought you had a type effectiveness against me? We're gonna fix that bullshit.
Eat shit. How about that? Boom!
Although I will say I've always thought that Archie had the better design between him and Maxie.
He did. You know what? This is slightly jumping into the topic at hand, but I want to talk about something now that they've come up. I was very interested because this is Pokemon Adventures. It follows the bit of a plot of the games, but it doesn't follow them exactly. And it takes some liberties with the characters, especially with details they haven't fully fleshed out. So it gives Archie and Maxie a couple different traits than they ever showed in the games. Now, I wouldn't say that Maxie and Archie are particularly deep characters, but I always, when I saw Maxie, saw him in a particular way. He always stands up very straight, arms to his side, usually maybe behind his back. So it has like this air of a very scientifically minded, very like smart, calculating kind of person. His fucking
big old glasses in the Omega. And
yeah, I was gonna say his Mega bracelet is his glasses in the new game. So he's kind of a nerd. In this, the first time you meet him, they establish that they're kind of like the Team Magma's almost like a bandit gang. Like he's in a traditional Japanese mountain bandit kind of style. He has like the cloak around him, carrying a bottle of booze, and like when his team's like, "What do we do next?" He's just like, "You guys do what you want." And I was like, I don't know if I'm cool with like this socialist fucking Maxie who's just like, you know, why do we even have money, guys? Like, why don't we just get rid of all of it? We just exchange what we need with one another. And you guys, I'm the leader of you only spiritually until our souls pass once more. You guys are really your own leader until we can all join together stronger as one. I'm like, I don't like this version. Then later on, he becomes completely normal Maxie. It's like they just kind of are like, right. Yeah, fuck it. But for like a hot moment, he was really different from what I expected.
Well, Archie is kind of weird because you see him and he's like, well, he's a pirate, right?
Yeah.
But then it turns out he's like the head of the biggest news outlet in the Hoenn region. And so he's controlling all the news so that Team Aqua's crimes don't get covered, but Team Magma's do. So that everyone turns against Team Magma and lets Team Aqua operate more efficiently. And then you look at Archie, you know, and it's like, how could you trust that man? Look at his facial hair. That is an evil man's facial hair.
I feel like it would have gone a lot differently if it were essentially a series like One Beyond. Nowadays, I don't think anyone would have an issue with it. Back then, that facial hair would be ridiculous for somebody in entertainment. But now I feel like that's the standard for what like people in the back scenes probably have. In fact, probably nowadays, people would be like, I don't trust this guy. His facial hair isn't eccentric enough. He needs like a couple flames shooting off of his mustache, maybe.
He needs his facial hair to defy gravity and go up at an upward angle.
Exactly.
So while this is going on, while we've got the two teams trying to get their legendary Pokemon to expand the land / sea, for very shallow reasons, like, it's basically just as weird as it is in the games, which is, the ocean is the source of life! People need land to live on! We need more of it! It's like, you don't think that, like, you know, the balance that nature has struck right now, like, changing it won't cause the world to... Okay, never mind.
It's... They had a concept that, like, we're gonna go land versus sea. And I get it. It's... technically a competitive thing, despite the fact the sea outnumbers the land like 9-1. Whatever. It's still that notion of just...
2-1, but okay.
Well, you shush your mouth up now. You hush up now, child. So, it's something they had to work with, and it's like, alright, they came to this decision. The two teams just want to increase the size of their terrain, essentially, and there's no possible reason they can give for it. And it's almost charming in how absolutely devoid of a plan it really is. It's just them being like, we're going to make the volcano erupt and create more land for everybody. Everyone will be so happy. End plan. Like, all right.
There is, I know you know about Nuzlocke.
Yes.
Back when they were first really getting popular, there were Nuzlocke comics. And one of my favorites was called Hail Emerald Hard Mode. And his interpretation of the characters was that Maxi basically said, yeah, I have Team Magma so that I can just oppose Team Aqua because his plan is stupid. And then eventually at the end when they've summoned Kyogre and Groudon, Archie's like, this is going to be great! You're going to have more ocean! And they're like, you know, when the world's covered by ocean, where are you going to live? Is it... I've been a horrible mistake. And that was it.
Shit, Nick, I'm about to blow your mind. Nuzlocke is still making comics.
I'm not surprised.
That is baffling to me. That's shit, cool, look, you need to understand, as a Pokemon and Lost nerd, Nuzlocke was the greatest thing in the world to me.
That's where the name came from. Yeah, was that his Nuzleaf was, he named him Locke.
Locke from Lost. Oh, so great. All right, we can't keep getting distracted like this. All right.
Anyhow, so that's the whole plan, that's the whole thing that's going on. That is the major plot. But meanwhile, we've got our two protagonists, Ruby and Sapphire. Ruby is the male protagonist from the games, and Sapphire is the female protagonist from the games.
The Brandon and May, if you will.
Yes. If you want to go for that. So while they're doing that, the two of them are starring on their respective Pokemon journeys. And the unique thing about this series is that each of them has a different goal. Because this was the generation that introduced Pokemon contests.
Huzzah!
Which were that thing I tried once and was like, nah, don't need to do this anymore.
I actually eventually did get into it, and it is kind of interesting, but it wasn't...
It's got a very fun system when you're actually playing it.
It is kind of cool to try to find ways to essentially jam up your opponent and still get points, but it was never... Almost everything in Pokemon that's like the side thing to do is never fleshed out enough to be worth it, so...
The one part of it that I always hated was the fact that you had to gather berries and make them into blocks.
And it was like, brutal. If you didn't have friends, it took forever. You couldn't get really good blocks.
Because the fucking CPUs are fucking pointless.
They're like, you're like, stop! Fuck it, it's so easy! It gets into a rhythm! Match with my rhythm! I'm like fucking, Pacific Rim, where I'm like, do it to my biometric!
And they do show that in the manga. It's like, here's the berry crunching into cube machine. And I'm like, oh, that fucking thing. That was the main reason I didn't do contests, was because you couldn't get your Pokemon high enough without them. Thank God they were just a completely side thing. Although if they weren't, they would probably have made that easy so you could do it by yourself.
Yeah.
So the thing is that, oh, well, in the anime series, Pokemon contests, who took part in those? May, Dawn, the female companion character. Who takes part in them in this series? Ruby, the dude, the main character, takes part in Pokemon contests. Meanwhile, May is the battle one who is going after the actual Pokemon gym leader league challenge. And it's not like just a gimmick too. It's really a big part of both of their characters. That ends up having a very big meaning at the end. Ruby, I mean, I had forgotten how much I love Ruby. He is one of my favorite adventure characters, I think. And what's also kind of weird about this series is that it really feels like it's his chapter. Sapphire is there, and she does do a lot of stuff, but it feels like Ruby gets, like, all the development in this.
Well, I think that's definitely 100% true, but that really comes into light the longer the series goes on. Because at the start, they really do kind of shape the idea that it's kind of both of them are the protagonists. And I'd honestly almost say I'm going to call her May a couple times during this. I apologize. It's just ingrained in me. Sapphire feels like more the protagonist at the start because she's the one doing the Pokemon gym journey and follows the most linear path. So the manga takes longer time kind of focusing on what she's doing as opposed to Ruby, who kind of bounces around. He'll, like, fall in the ocean, and it's like, boom, he's seven routes down the line or whatever. And, you know, meanwhile, Sapphire's, like, due for town, now to Slatepert, you know, the Trick Master's house. Like, it's a lot easier to kind of follow her. So at the start, she actually is a little bit more what you'd expect as the main character, just as she follows very much the expected sort of path. But as you said, as the story goes on, it ultimately does become a little bit more about Ruby. I should say a lot more about Ruby because it has to deal with his issues with his father, because this is one of the cool things. This is the only gen that I know of where your parents are actually characters, well, your dad at least, is an actual character in the series. I don't know if they've ever had anyone else's dad show up at some point in the Pokemon adventure, but because Norman's an actual character, your dad is a character in Ruby and Sapphire, that's something they get to deal with, and it's kind of cool to see that happen. And that plays a very large part into how everything kind of ties up at the end of this, not to jump ahead, but there's a lot of development between those two.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, other than just, well, they go through the plots of Ruby and Sapphire, really the only thing I think there is really to talk about is, you know, the characters. And I wanted to say mainly and mostly at the same time. I should have chosen one and gone with it. Mainly, it's down to just, you know, Ruby and Sapphire, but also Wally and Norman, I think, deserve a lot of talking. So, I don't know, I guess let's just talk, you know, Ruby and Sapphire. Ruby is, as someone who is, you know, obsessed with taking on the Pokemon appeal challenges, by the way, if anyone doesn't really know what Pokemon contests are, like, if you completely ignored that whole option in the games, essentially what you do is that instead of leveling up your Pokemon for battle, you level them up in five categories of appeal, which are like, what, toughness, coolness, smart, beauty, and
coolness, toughness, beauty, cuteness, and smart.
Oh, cuteness and beauty are separate categories. That's so weird to me.
Well, it's like, Nick, and, you know, like when you're saying like that chick's really hot versus saying she's really cute, you know, like it's two different things.
Yes, but they're Pokemon.
that argument I feel like every dude had with his friends when they were 12 years old. There's
a horde of people descend on me. There is a difference.
They're like, no, Nick, hold on a moment. All right. It goes like, look, Marianne, she's cute. But Ginger, she's hot. And everyone in the chat's like, what the fuck are you talking about, you old piece of shit? And I'm like, no! They used to air Gilligan's Island a lot on TV Land, alright? I'm not old!
So, he is obsessed with his Pokemon looking, you know, very attractive. For them to look generally beautiful. Because everything is measured on appeal in the Pokemon contests. And he makes this bet with Mei when they first encounter each other in the series because they are completely different. You know, Ruby is obsessed with himself looking good. Whenever there is a Pokemon battle going on near him, he's like, I don't want to be near that. My Pokemon will get dirty and I'll get dirty. No. It's kind of a running gag that comes up every now and then. Like, you know, at one point he saves someone from a collapsed cave by having his, I believe it's a marsh stomp at this point, dig under it. But he knows that this plan is going to send a whole bunch of mud flying everywhere. So there's this really funny panel where he knows what's going to happen. So he's just kind of running away while it's going on and everyone else who's in the area gets sprayed with mud. Meanwhile, the first time he encounters Mei, he thinks she's a Pokemon because she's, like, just covered in moss and foliage. And, yeah, she looks like a cave girl.
Yes.
When he places her.
She always has fangs. She always has, like, the little, like, canine fangs. But when she's first introduced, she also has claws. Like,
yeah, she literal hasn't trimmed her nails claws. For a while.
And you're sort of just like, Professor Birch, not for nothing. How long do you just let her hang out in the wilderness?
And she explains by saying, I was helping with my father's research. Because
and I'm like, doesn't explain the grass skirt very much. I know there's better
regular clothes.
There's
anyway.
Better forms of camouflage out there. But it really doesn't explain those claws.
Ruby is Norman's son. Norman the gym leader's son in this. And Sapphire is Professor Birch, the Pokemon professor of this series, daughter. So, there's a connection there. Mm. And, so they encounter each other, and obviously, okay, this guy who's very obsessed with his appearance versus this girl who really doesn't care much at all for her appearance encounter each other. And of course, they don't really get along at all. Especially because their priorities are completely different. Mei is like, you should be a strong battler. And Ruby's like, but if my Pokemon battle, they'll get dirty. You know? So, they just don't respect each other. They don't respect each other's ideals. And so they make this bet against each other. It's Sapphire's idea, which is, all right, well, if you're so obsessed with, you know, taking on these Pokemon contests, well, I want to take on the gym battles, so we'll meet back with each other in 80 days, and we'll see if each other has achieved their goal. I'll take on the gyms, you take on the contests, and then we'll see. And so he agrees to that, because he's planning on doing it anyway. So that's our rivalry. They don't actually fight against each other, like, at all in this entire thing. There's, like, no battle where they go against each other.
Yeah, no, there isn't.
So instead they just have these, you know, different goals that they're going after, and they're rivals in that respect. So, oh, and, Ruby is just like, let's see, Sapphire gets knocked out, and Ruby saves her from something. I forget what it is at the beginning. But he's like, well, you know, if you're going to go off and I'm going to have to, you know, associate with you and declare you my rival and stuff, can you, like, at least wear, you know, proper clothes? And he leaves her this note, which is, I've modified my spare change of clothes for you, so please wear them. I think that you'll look good in them. And she's like, did he fucking take my measurements while I was asleep?
I'm like, look, you're 11, girl. You don't have measurements yet.
She's 10.
There you go. Even better. Wait, that sounded wrong. Oh, Sviper, I think, is what causes the
right.
Damn. Sviper's such an awesome Pokemon. I'm sorry. I'm going to nostalgia bomb over so many Pokemon.
There are quite a few badass Pokemon that pop up in this series. And they do run into each other every now and then when, through the course of their journey, they just happen to, you know, cross paths. And they're all constantly like, what are you doing here? What are you doing here? All right, well, let's get through this, and then we'll go our separate ways once we're done. We stop by with them, and of course, they occasionally come across Team Aqua and Team Magma while they're at it.
It's a really interesting kind of way that this story goes, because as you mentioned before, it follows the plot of the games, and there's not a whole lot, to be honest. You know, it follows the beats. Something has to be stolen from Mr. Stone at the start of it. There's some issue with meeting Steven in a cave on Dewford Island. There's, you know, the stealing of the sub, the volcano, Professor Cosmo in Mount Falls, or whatever the Meteor Falls, I believe. All those beats are in there, but it's given a lot more flavor because they're allowed to expand and write upon what already exists. Each of the teams has essentially three admins below the leader, and two of them are from the games. I think at least one of them from each side is completely original. And this manga's done a lot to take what were just pushover characters. I don't think I've ever found the admins in any, like, Pokemon game to be that interesting. And turned all of them into legitimately interesting characters with unique viewpoints and ways of kind of operating. Like, the team...
I think Courtney got a big popularity boost as a result of this manga.
She gets enough, like, focus to almost be, like, a, like, secondary character in this. Mm-hmm. And all of these characters have unique styles and ways of fighting. Like, even within Team Magma, something where, like, as simple as, you know, Pokemon that are fire type generally, there's somebody who uses fires to create illusions to try to trick their opponents. Mm-hmm. Whereas Courtney's case, she just sets fires everywhere because even if she can't.
She's got a great speech where she's explaining, these are what the three flames do. You know, he specializes in using using Torkoal's charcoal attacks. He specializes in using flames for illusions. And me, I just prefer to set stuff on fire.
Yeah. And I love how she explains. She's like, I'm just going to set everything on fire. And eventually, you're probably going to lose. Or something you love is going to be burned down and you'll lose trying to protect it. Or something like that. And what I really love is that, you know, because the admins are the ones that generally have to be the ones going out because the characters can't, you know, meet the leaders that early on, it would be really easy to just make the admins jokes, to make them punching bags for the heroes. But not the case in this at all. The admins are all shown to be very competent, and they almost always either defeat the heroes or get away essentially with the objective. So they barely ever are, like, outright defeated. So you constantly are in this sense of having the stakes built up because you know that these admins are actually capable threats to our heroes, to the point where there's a big battles between them and gym leaders later on.
They're kicking the gym leaders' asses for the most part.
Yeah, and like in creative ways too. And it's really satisfying just seeing the extent that these characters are kind of built up and made into legitimate threats. You're like, holy shit, I couldn't have told you the dude in Team Aqua. But now I'm like, yeah, it's Matt. He's the dude who has like an entire plan to drown fucking Flannery inside of a wire
car. Good thing that this cable car is completely airtight for some reason.
Thank God. I don't know why I didn't just keep filling it with water and then let you drown. Especially when I had an air bubble, but whatever. I'm dumb. I'm mad. Yeah, but he didn't fill it up all the way. Then he started attacking. It's dumb. Just keep filling it up. They'll drown.
Well, he did fill it all the way up.
Yeah, I guess he did.
They escaped because Sapphire snatched Sharpedo's teeth.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. That's the point. It was, why attack? Just watch her drown.
Right. Why leave anything to chance? It's like that one guy who decided that he wanted to be a man and attack Yusei when all he needed to do was wait until the next turn because Yusei had no more cards in his deck. But no, he was like, I want to engage in battle. And so Yusei countered his attack and they won that way. By these reference. Okay. It was the stupidest ending to it. It was like four episodes for fucking that.
I want a tangent so hard, but we got to stay on point here. I really enjoy what this series has done with a lot of the side characters in it, particularly, and we mentioned this before, because the manga is basically interpretation of the video games, it's allowed to have a lot more freedom, particularly when it comes to the gym leaders. But I think in this version, more than others, it stays true to what we know about the gym leaders while giving them a bit more flavor. There's a scene, I don't want to get too far into this, but it's not too much of a spoiler to say eventually Kyogre and Groudon are out in the world causing shit. And essentially the gym leaders are sent out to deal with it. However, Winona, who was always one of the more forgettable Honin gym leaders, in my opinion, is given the prominent role in this. She's essentially the responsible tactical leader of all the gym leaders. She's the leader of the Hoenn gym leaders.
And you see her without her aviator cap, which is weird because she's still got the wing hair. I always just kind of assumed it was just like kind of sprouting out under the aviator cap before I saw her in this.
I also had a revelation about this. Two, actually. One for Winona. I didn't realize that she was just putting on a flight suit over regular clothes. And why a flight suit is essentially like a onesie pair of hot pants with like a top to it. But then secondly, I don't know why, I always thought that May Sapphire's outfit was like a shirt that just went really long and then a pair of bicycle shorts. I didn't realize it's a shirt with then a skirt and then a pair of bicycle shorts that go way farther beyond it. I was like, what's the point of the skirt then? But anyways, Winona has
this... fashionable. It's designed by Ruby.
That is true. Is that Winona is essentially the leader of the Hoenn characters, and she really wants to help get involved in these fights, but essentially she's sent to the middle of Hoenn to basically coordinate between the two teams out fighting the two legendaries and the Pokemon League. And there's this big dramatic moment when the Pokemon League essentially shows up, and they're like, we're here now, Winona, you're relieved, you can join the battlefield, and Wallace is there. And they've built in this moment to kind of establish that Wallace and Winona kind of have feelings for one another. That there's like a romance.
They used to be in a relationship at one point.
And it's this heartwarming scene, because you see them two kind of grab and hold on to hands before they take off. Winona on her Altaria, this majestic bird, and of course Wallace in his flying car, which is... fucking ridiculous. I just need to note how stupid this flying car is.
Flying car is one of the most important items in this plot, by the way.
It's so weird. I get there weren't many flying water types at the time, but it's so confusing. It's so, like, immersive breaking when you see him taking up in this beautiful shot. I don't have the volume with me right now. It's downstairs and I'm annoyed because I wish I had it, because it's this otherwise beautiful moment in shot of her flying off to one battle, him flying off to the other one, and she's on this majestic bird and he's like, I'm in my flying car, you know. It's like, this is so breaking to my immersion of the Pokemon world.
I think that you're stretching the definition of beautiful when you describe Altaria, which is Cloud Dodo Dragon.
But there is a majesticness to that. And especially within the context of a Pokemon world, it's just, it's juxtaposed against the notion of just this flying car, which only has one other piece of like real reference in it, which is Ruby's running shoes, which have just jet propellers in them and don't really play much of a role in the story. He just has them.
So getting back to the main pair, Sapphire has mostly regular adventures to begin with, when she's encountering the gym leaders. She has different challenges, and this is the generation where they were really building up in the games, like, okay, each gym leader has a real gimmick to them. Mm. So they have a bit more fun with the challenges that she has to take on. Like, her first one is Roxanne, and they play into Roxanne's, you know, like, academy gym. And she's like, I get so many challengers that I have you take a written exam and then I take on the top scorer in that. And Sapphire is, you know, this wild girl who doesn't talk good and doesn't know know words well much, but she's the daughter of a Pokemon professor. So after she gets a bunch of help on understanding the vocabulary of the test, she's like, I got 100. then she takes on Brawly, the fighting type guy, and he's got this whole, like, judo thing that he's got going on, and so she has to essentially predict what his strategy is going to be, as she's preparing for the battle the night before. And then there's fucking Watson, who's fucking annoying.
He's great! Fuck you! Watson's amazing! All of his shitty puns and his god-awful gym challenge when a bunch of kids come up and he beats them all and they're like, you tried really hard, badges for everybody!
Which, by the way, I have a huge problem with. Sapphire makes this big deal when she encounters Watson. I had forgotten how her gym challenge actually goes. Because she does this big thing where, you know, Watson's just like, oh, well, I really admire your spunk, kid. You have my gym badge. And she's like, no! I took on the gym challenge in order to really test myself and push myself as a trainer and grow stronger. I don't want a gym badge for doing absolutely nothing. And then she doesn't battle him for it. She doesn't battle a lot of the gym leaders for theirs. She does defeat quite a few. But Winona beats her and still gives her the badge.
it works with that. Yeah, it is weird in that. But it works in the sense that Winona essentially becomes her master, which is a cool aspect of the story, is essentially both Ruby and Sapphire find mentors in the gym leaders, and that becomes
appropriately enough, under the two that were in a relationship previously.
Yeah, but that's so. Like, that kind of works because she loses
foreshadowing.
She loses to Winona and then starts to mentor underneath her and eventually reaches the point where Winona, like, recognizes her talent, respects her, and gives her the badge. So I didn't have so much of an issue with that. But yeah, the Dynamo badge is definitely a situation where she's like...
Because she was like, I'll help you out with finding this lost city if then you give me an appropriate challenge for the gym badge. And then she finds them in the city, and they don't battle. He just gives her the gym badge. Like, maybe they did it off-panel. I'm going to hope that they did.
Actually, now that you mention it, she barely beats anybody.
She beats Flannery. Roxanne and Brawly and Flannery.
Who does she
trains with Juan and Tate and Liza, and they do beat Tate and Liza, but she has Ruby's help for it, which is cheating.
Well, it makes sense in that. I always thought it...
It is a double battle.
Yeah.
Gosh, who is...
She doesn't beat Wallace, does she? No, she just recognizes. Well, I guess Juan gives her the badge.
I think she gets it from Juan, and he's one of their trainers at the end too. Ooh, God, who was Norman?
The one,
and you never see her take on Norman.
Yeah, we know that she does beat him for the badge, but it happens kind of off screen.
Which is kind of the disappointing thing is that, I mean, I do really like what we get out of Ruby and Sapphire, but Ruby gets so much good stuff in this arc, and it really does feel like Sapphire is along for the ride at points. And it felt the second time through, it was like, man, I really wish that Sapphire had kind of gotten more of that second protagonist focus that, you know, that Blue got, that Crystal got, where it feels like she doesn't get as much development independent of Ruby, unfortunately.
I think part of the issue, and this is kind of getting into spoilers at this point, so I don't know if we want to hold off on it.
Let's hold off.
All right. So I'll just mention there are some issues that come in with Ruby and Sapphire. Mm-hmm. And it all kind of culminates towards the end. But Sapphire is still a character I feel like you could definitely enjoy, and there's no reason not to. She's a fun character. She has a real arc to her. She does grow and change as the series goes along, and there's very fun and cool moments to her. But I completely agree. She does get the short end of the stick, particularly when it comes to the conclusion of everything, too.
Mm-hmm.
But I still really enjoy her because of how fun she is. She felt more memorable to me. Both Ruby and Sapphire in this felt more like much more memorable characters than any of the other protagonists we've seen in this. Like, I think for the most part, like Gold and Red were kind of interchangeable with one another. I felt like they would react to situations generally the same way. Whereas Ruby, I'd be like, no, he's going to react to situations very differently because he's very haughty and about himself and, you know, trying to avoid things. And
I got you. Like Gold is like arrogant. Gold is like a twist on Red, and Silver is like a twist on Blue.
Yeah.
But Ruby is completely different from them, and Sapphire is completely different from Green and completely different from Crystal.
Yeah, so it's nice that those two kind of have their own fleshed-out characters, and that makes them a lot more interesting to follow with his story. I think if I were to point out like a big issue with the entire adventure, though, it's that there's so much going on, there's almost too much going on at times.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things that just kind of end up being shortchanged towards the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Wally's a big one. I guess there's an Emerald at some point that we get, and he probably is a...
Emerald comes in, you see him hinted towards in a little bit of a glimpse at one point in this arc.
Yeah, so I imagine he plays a little bit there, but that's like a story that kind of ends up not going as far as you'd want.
Well, once you find Emerald, you'll wish that Wally had just been the third protagonist.
Oh,
honestly.
Really? Oh, that's a shame.
Wally doesn't get too much to do. I think that we can talk about him without really getting into spoilers too much. But basically, like in the games, Rayquaza has to be the one to generate peace between Grodon and Kyogre, and Norman essentially takes Wally to help him to release Rayquaza to do this. And Wally gets to be a fucking badass. If you don't remember Wally, he's this sick kid that you encounter in the third generation of games. He's got, like, really bad asthma or something like that.
Some kind of debilitating sickness. It's never addressed in the games, but here they kind of firmly establish it to be some kind of disorder that comes in with his breathing.
And he dreams of going on a Pokemon journey, but he's not strong enough to do it. So he befriends Ruby, and Ruby's like, okay, well, you know, this is how you catch your Pokemon and stuff. And they end up actually getting separated by, like, a flood. And Ruby's Ralts ends up going along with Wally on his Pokemon journey. And Wally's got this, like, special set of clothing, so he's got this badass-looking breathing apparatus in his collar that makes him look like makes him look like a killer.
it's really well done, and I appreciate it because they don't shy away from the notion. They're like, look, Wally's a sick kid. Like, in the games, it's kind of just like, assume that he overcomes his illness enough to challenge you. Because it's never really brought up again when you finally fight him at the end.
I'm healthy now. Check out my Gardevoir.
Whereas, which become a Glade later on because Gardevoir was too feminine for me, I guess. But essentially, in this, they don't shy away from the fact that even though he's on this adventure, he's got his own Pokemon, he's training them, he's raising them, he's still sick. He finishes something exciting, and he has to, like, sit down, and, like, I think it's even Ralts who, like, has to activate his breathing apparatus, put it on him, because he's starting to, like, have difficulties breathing. You're like, it's cool to see that he's still struggling with this disability, but it doesn't impede him. He won't let it stop him, basically. And I'm like, that makes him a lot more appealing. Unfortunately, this whole thing that he does with Rayquaza ultimately just ends up being, great job, you unlocked Rayquaza, I'll take things from here, bye, and like,
Norman.
I don't even think he's in the final battle. I think he's leaves him on Skypillar and is like, good luck falling, getting down the stairs.
Well, that kind of happens with Sapphire too. She's not really in the final battle either.
Well, she does get to the
morning, but
the
she's
end.
Not in the final part of it, yeah.
Yeah, well, the whole part with Rayquaza kind of feels like almost like a pulling the rug out from underneath you, because you think Wally's going to be that third character, and he's not. Mm-hmm. It's a Norman thing that plays into
it. He definitely gets his moment to shine the spotlight, and I think it's really nice that they do. But yeah, honestly, like, thinking about what happens with Emerald, like, oh, you should just had Wally do it.
it's a shame.
And they tease you with it, too, because he ends up with with Trico for a little while, and trains up a little bit. He's not that Trico's final trainer.
No, it's a shame too, because Trico's my favorite of that gen. I was hoping to see more of him.
So I guess we have to kind of like head backwards a bit, because in order to finish explaining this, we kind of have to just go through Ruby's arc, really. Mentioned before, Ruby is Norman's kid. Ruby's got daddy issues. he really does. Because as the son of a gym leader, you know, Norman's kind of really made him train for battle in this. But Ruby doesn't want to do that. We don't find out why until basically the very end of the series. But he doesn't want to go and be a huge, terrible battler. He wants to do beautiful Pokemon contests. And you find out really early on that Ruby has a really strong knack for battling. He is one of the strongest Pokemon battlers in the series. He takes on Pokemon that are way stronger than his own, and just his knack for tactics and his precision when commanding them lets him take them out, and take them out really easily. And anyone who watches him in action is like, wow, you've got a really strong talent for this. And he's like, oh, I don't know what's going on. What are you talking about? Just got lucky.
Yeah.
You know, the boat rocked around and threw the Pokemon up bounds. That was it. Yeah.
It's, I'm trying to find an example of it. Here you go. So at the end of the volumes, like at the end of every so often with chapters in the volumes, they'll give you like a status page that essentially shows you mm-hmm. where the characters are, what their Pokemon are. And if you look over to Sapphire, it probably isn't very easy to see.
It's very blurry.
Yeah, but they show you that she has levels next to her Pokemon to give you that kind of data, which makes sense. She's the battler. They don't give you that for Ruby. Instead, they show you, like, essentially where his Pokemon's weight on the appeal trail. But that also kind of helps to hide the fact that he's actually a really good battler, because they keep hiding his Pokemon's level.
I mean, like, you see, for example, his Mudkip does evolve into Marsh Stomp and into Swampert. All his Pokemon do evolve as he goes on his journey, because he does get involved in battles, even though he doesn't really want to. But even before that point, he's kicking ass. And anyone who sees him actually, like I said, is like, oh yeah, you're kind of a kick-ass trainer. I don't know what you're talking about. No, everything must be lovely and beautiful. But of course, it's because he's been under strict training from his father. And relatively early in the story, we get one of my favorite battles in this entire series, which is between Norman and Ruby. Because Ruby runs away from home to go on his journey. And of course, his dad's like, we're going to bring that kid home. He's getting in trouble. And they wreck each other. It's only like a 2-chapter-long battle. All the battles in this series are pretty short, but they go to town. They're inside of this, like, decrepit building during a huge thunderstorm. Norman's got his Slay King and Vigoroth out. Slay King's throwing a staircase around and using it like a freaking club. Ruby comes up with this plan to redirect Marsh Stomp's mud bomb through pipes in the building. I really, really like the battle, and then it ends with the... It begins, by the way, with Norman just holding Ruby up by the freaking collar of his shirt. Like, what the fuck are you doing running around like this? It kind of has this very, oh, Ruby, you idiot. Now I understand that this story is about you being a stupid kid. Which is basically what this entire arc is about in terms of Ruby's character development, is that he's a stupid, stubborn kid who needs to grow up and talk to people around him better. Because it turns out that if he had just waited a little bit longer, then his dad was actually going to give him permission to go on a Pokemon journey in order to participate in Pokemon contests. Because Norman's actually kind of a cool dad.
Which is weird, because at the start, you're, like, terrified at the idea that Ruby's going to encounter him, because he looks like a serial killer. Like, he's like, my son's around here! Like, basically, you just assume in every shot that doesn't show his hands that they're just clenched in a fist, ready to punch his son in the face as soon as he sees him. You're like, oh my god, run, Ruby, run! Use your magic running shoes that only really kind of blew up girls' skirts in that one scene.
Norman is a badass in this story. One of the things that actually best exemplifies it is when the gym leaders meet up. And Tate and Liza aren't there because they're getting their asses kicked by Team Magma. And the gym leaders are like, well, there's these people who are trying to expand land. Well, there's these people who are trying to expand the ocean. And they divide up, like, three of the gym leaders are each like, well, Team Magma's great. Well, no, Team Aqua's great. What are you talking about? Team Magma's awful. And then they're like, well, Norman, you should break the tie. And Norman's like, both of them suck. I'm not making a decision on this. He just walks out. He's like, that guy gets in.
That actually kind of reminded me, though, of something that saddened me, because you just mentioned that scene where essentially the two sides are divided on this because they both have an idea on which side's right and which one's wrong. And they're divided basically right down the middle, but it doesn't actually play off into anything. Like, neither, like, they don't have a fight between the gym leaders or anything like that. It's kind of brought up, they pick sides, and then a little bit after that, they're like, oh, wait, no, both teams suck. All right, we'll go out to both teams then. You're like, oh, I was kind of hoping for a little bit of, like, more conflict.
Well, we just got gym leader versus gym leader in the last arc.
Yeah, but I'm noting, like, with the way they built it up, I thought it was weird. Just kind
I get you. There's, like, an entire chapter dedicated to it, and it doesn't really go anywhere.
Yeah.
So what happens with Ruby is it turns out he's actually kind of a selfish dick. He is so determined just to win this Pokemon contest and to not battle that all this stuff is happening. They know that these two horrible monsters are going to destroy the world by fighting against each other. And the gym leaders know what's going on. They're gathering forces. They recruit Mei to join them because they're like, oh, yeah, you got talent. You could help us out. And Mei's starting to get to know Ruby better by this point. They've been through more trials together. He's helped her out. And finally, he ends up saving her from, like, a swarm of Grumpig. There you go. And she realizes, you're actually a really strong battler. And he's like, And just like, no, you're not going to fool me anymore. You should help us out, because you've got all this ability. You could really make a big difference. And he's like, nah, I'm not interested. I don't want to get involved. The world is going to end unless they stop them. And he's just like, no, I just want to do Pokemon contests. And so it's actually a really heartbreaking scene after that, because she's like, I thought that you actually were, I kind of was getting the impression you were a good person. I was starting to see that, you know, beneath all of this, you know, all this pompousness, that you had a good heart to you and that you were willing to help people out. Well, now I see that you're just, you know, completely selfish and awful. So, you know what? I don't want this gift anymore. And she actually, like, tears off the outfit that he made for her and throws it in his face and is like, I don't want to ever see you again. And it's kind of awkward because she strips in front of him to do it.
Thank God she's still at her fucking grass.
She's like immediately like, ah, oh, good trees. But, you know, she reverts to the way that she was at the start of the series before she kind of begrudgingly accepted his gift and started to get to like him more and more. And she's really angry with him and kind of gets back to that feral state that she was in before. And, he's like, okay, fine. And, like, the world, the cities are, like, flooding, earthquakes are happening, and he still shows up and Tsutaba's like, all right, gotta take a part in a Pokemon contest. He's, like, the only one there, because everyone else is evacuated because of the floods.
Everyone else is like, oh, God, shit's got real.
And so he's like, whatever, I'm just gonna finish this up, and I'm gonna, you know, I'll get my ribbons, just give me my ribbons, I know I'm the only one here. Which, I mean, is a really stupid way of going about it. Like, I won the Pokemon contest that no one else was competing.
By default, go me!
And Wallace shows up and kicks his ass in the beauty segments. Everybody's like, did you literally just do this, you know, just to take this away from me? How could you do this to me? And Wallace is just like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
It all kind of ties into with another really great Pokemon of that gen, Phoebus, which...
Mm-hmm. The God, ugly fish.
Catching the Phoebus in the original game was annoying
sucks.
As shit. But if you did it... 1%
in that one region, yeah.
6 tiles in an entire map.
Yeah, that's right.
It was a 50% chance if you got that tile, but it was 6 tiles on an enormous route that changed every day, basically. And the whole thing is that it only evolved if its beauty was raised max. I mean, now I think you trade an item with it and it does it, but...
You can trade, yeah, a scale with it.
It was that story within a Pokemon, the same way Magikarp was a lesson about patience and not, you know, expecting something weak to be something, you know, not that great when it gets better, you know. It was like, hey, patient, you're rewarded for your efforts. Phoebus was a story about, you know, seeing the beauty in something else, and when you do so, it gets to become something amazing. And they'll talk.
And Ruby was having Phoebus be his beauty Pokemon for a very selfish reason, which was, if I can win the beauty contest with this ugly fucking thing, that'll prove how great I am. And then when Fuse doesn't win the beauty portion because Wallace is kicking his ass, he's just like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You're not bringing it. What is your, you ugly thing? Why can't you be beautiful like this majestic goddamn thing I've seen pictures of? And Phoebus is so hurt that it runs away. And Wallace is like, you lost because of your failures as a trainer. Phoebus is trying his hardest, and you're the only reason you've lost. And look at what you've done. And look at what's happening around you, and you're focused on petty things like this. And, you know, Ruby freaks out over what he's done. You know, he's just like, cost himself a lot of his friends. And he has this big, huge freak out about it. And he, like, tries to, you know, dive into the flooding building to try and recover Phoebus. And, no, that's not going to work. There's also a swimmer who doesn't get a name who shows up all throughout this story. Who's kind of got Ruby's back throughout it.
Yeah.
And he shows up at that point, but, and then at the end, Ruby kind of gets his act together. And he's like, okay, yeah, I'll help out, because essentially what he realizes is he's got a piece of information that everyone needs in order to, reset everything. They end up summoning, Regirock, Regice, and Registeel, which I don't know exactly what they actually do.
They basically form a barrier to keep the destruction between the two from destroying the rest of the region.
Oh, okay.
Basically contain it.
Right. Gives them time in order to actually stop the conflict itself. But in order to do that, in the games there's this really weird puzzle you've got to solve that involves having Waylord and Relicanth in your party at certain positions. And so they're like, well, how are we going to get down there in order to do this? And Drew's like, wait, I happen to know this piece of information from talking with a fisherman, but I've got to step forward and actually enter into this conflict. And he's like, well, I've been running away and hiding this whole time. I should actually own up and up and do this. And that's when he starts to really get set on his path to redemption, and he starts saying things right. He comes to an understanding with Sapphire, and they make amends. They learn to work together. And at the very end of it, Phoebus finds him again. And protects him in the big final battle. And Phoebus is getting injured by Archie and Maxie. And they're like, ah, just get rid of that ugly thing. And he's like, I think that she's beautiful. And she evolves into Milotic in order to help them in the last battle. And then we get the childhood flashback in between that.
There's a lot to kind of digest.
There's a lot of different things.
It's actually one of the issues I have with this. With this part, is that it keeps trying to kind of explain more mm-hmm. and add more details to almost kind of like raise the drama of things mm-hmm. to a point where it almost starts to undo itself. It doesn't add anything to the story after a while, but like something as simple as Norman wasn't around when they were kids, when Ruby was young. It's like, all right, it's because he was trained to become a gym leader. It's kind of self-explanatory. He's doing this for his family. He's becoming a gym leader. He's following his own path, but then it's like,
it was all Ruby's fault.
And they're like, really, he was actually running after Rayquaza, trying to find him for 5 years. And then it's not even enough to say that. Then it's like, oh, and also the whole reason this happened is because of it's Ruby's fault, which is horseshit. I just want to note, it is horseshit that they try to blame it on Ruby. Essentially, what happens is the scientists are researching Rayquaza in a lab, and outside of it, independently, Ruby has a wild salamance fucking attack him, so he defends himself. The salamance, mm-hmm. wounded, just happens to, like, crash into the lab and starts fucking things up and releases Rayquaza with the attack. And his dad's like, oh, shit, this is Ruby's fault. It's like, one, how is this Ruby's fault? His only other option was to just get killed. It's not like he, like, had, like, an attack in his mind. He's like, if I do that, that salamance might retreat into my dad's lab. There's nothing like that. He's like, go away, salamance. Don't kill me.
And he wasn't doing it just to protect himself. He was also doing it to protect this helpless little girl with him.
So Salamence, yep. like, goes into this lab where they're apparently just like, we don't have any guards here.
Oh, no, we can't stop him. A child could command Pokemon to stop you, but we are helpless to stop your rampage.
They're like, security's so tight in here, no one could possibly get in. But we didn't expect for our lab, housing a very dangerous Pokemon, to have any emergency security in place for a dangerous Pokemon attack.
And it happens to be a flying dragon, no less.
And at the end of this, Ruby's dad's like, it's your fault, son, but I'm going to take the heat for you. It's like, no, it's not. It's not his fault.
I mean, that's kind of, I do agree. Like, when you're getting, especially towards the end of this arc, it's throwing so much at you when you have yet to digest stuff that's come before it. And it does feel like overcrowded, but honestly, I think that reflects the kind of attitude with progressing through Pokemon games is they keep on introducing more and more and more. And in terms of like having a game with content in it, that's a good thing. But in terms of just having a cohesive narrative, that is requiring it to fit in more and more and more elements to it. So, I mean, I get the impression that once we get to Gen 4, which has, like, you know, 25 legendary Pokemon in it or something like that, we're just going to be like, God damn it.
Well, it's one thing.
We'll see.
I imagine, you know, we didn't read again the Leaf Green and Fire Red part of this. And
right.
There's quite a few legendaries that don't appear in this at all. Deoxys, mm-hmm. Latias, Latios, Jirachi. I imagine they probably show up in those parts between Emerald and Fire Red, Leaf Green, maybe. It's just the notion that the story keeps adding more details. It starts adding onto the relationship with Ruby and Sapphire and saying, oh, they actually have known each other since they were kids. Mm-hmm. Oh, they don't realize they do. And oh, when they were kids, their roles were kind of reversed. You know, Sapphire mm-hmm. was a girly girl and Ruby was a traditional kind of like rough and tough boy. And this event happened, this misunderstanding that both caused them to go down these paths. It's details that aren't in their, like, in and of themselves bad or like uninteresting, but it doesn't need
it. If you had started off the story by saying, why is Sapphire this way? Well, I used to be a really girly girl when I was a kid, but I met this boy who protected me from this Salamence, and I was a burden to him, so I decided I would never be a burden to him again. I would grow stronger. Why is Ruby so obsessed with appearance? Well, I used to be really rough and tough, but I met this girl, and I ended up getting hurt protecting her from this Salamence, and I looked horrifying and bloody. And so I decided I would never, you know, have that appearance in front of someone again. I would never look so frightening. So that's why I don't battle. And so they each changed as a result of each other not knowing who the other was when they reunited. We don't learn that detail until, like, the second-to-last volume of this story. And I agree. There's so much going on in this whole thing that you don't have time to really draw out a lot of the best parts of the story. There's no room really for just expansion on things. Everything's got to be so condensed that it all fits in together. Cause, I mean, that moment at the end where, you know, like, Sapphire basically admits she's got a crush on Ruby now. And Ruby realizes who she is because she tells him her story. And he decides he can't take her into the final battle. And so he, like, you know, shoves her down off of down into the flying car so that she'll be sealed away and protected. And he takes his hat off to show the scars he got from Salamence.
Two things. One, why is the flying car locked from the outside to keep someone inside?
It's remote control. They established that.
That's stupid. Two, that's a hat? That's a hat? For years, this has always been... Where's a better shot of it? There. This has always been his hair. That's his hair. I don't care what you say. That is his hair.
They say it's a hat in like chapter one.
No, that's ridiculous. That is his hat. His hair. Whatever.
See, now he's got you.
I'm stuck.
So there are a lot of moments in the build of the relationship between the two of them. By the way, this is like the one of the few times where you get like legit romance in this story, which of course then they're like, well, they're both 11 years old, so, and this is a Pokemon manga for kids, so we're not gonna follow through on that. So he has amnesia, maybe. So, but they build up the relationship between the two, and I think that those are some of the strongest parts of this arc, is the interaction between them, seeing the way their relationship changes. And honestly, when I was remembering this story arc, those are the parts that stood out to me the most. Like, oh, that was so great, you know, when he reveals who he is and he shows off the scars to her, when she confesses to him, when he decides to go off on his own and he teams up with Norman and stuff. It's all the stuff in between that has to be so condensed down that really, I think, pulls it back because there's not as much room to just appreciate what you built up in those moments. Because there's so much you gotta fit in with 8 gym leaders, 2 teams of bad guys, legends with the frickin' keys to awaken the Titans, and the training for Wally in order to get up to get to Rayquaza, and
and essentially the same time exhausting. All this is going on, it's Kyogre and Groudon fighting in a cataclysmic event that's tearing Hoenn apart. So it's, and this is actually something I love about this, the fight between those two feels titanic. It feels colossal.
When they emerge out of the ground from their sleeping places, you get 2-page spreads for each of them. They're just the Pokemon emerging, and they feel massive, partially because everything else is so crammed down to little panels so that you can get the action going so much between page to page, and then everything stops for this one huge Pokemon to come up from the ground or the water.
And there's always storms going on, and when the two of them fight, like, it's implied, like, they're so evenly matched that the force between them can't, like, one can't overtake the other, so the energy is just dispersing, essentially, into the ground, and it's lifting Sotoopolis out of the ground, and it's just, you feel that this real tension is drawn in such a powerful way that it really feels catastrophic. They create this idea that these disasters are truly hitting without needing to really be gratuitous in showing, like, deaths or anything like that. It's kind of implied that definitely bad stuff is happening. At the very least, people are losing their homes because you do see cities just swallowed by the sea and things like that. But it's just this notion that everything feels like it actually is coming to an end, and the tension is just palpable because of that. So it really didn't need more, I feel like, in adding more details into the story. We kind of already were at the point we were. Ruby has, or Sapphire has feelings for him. We already kind of knew that. There's stuff going on. Ruby's dad and his abandonment feelings are very significant. That, you know, we didn't need more of. And when it adds that other stuff, it's kind of just almost lost because there's so much more going on. And it ultimately doesn't detract from my ability to enjoy the story. The climax to this adventure is great. It's fantastic. It feels big. It's a little weirdly executed because essentially they build this idea that Ruby and Sapphire have a big dramatic thing they have to do together, and it seems
and then
like
they don't.
It seems like it's going to be about defeating Kyogre and Groudon, and then at, like, the last moment, it's like, no, it's actually about Ruby and his dad defeating them, and then it's going to be about those two defeating.
Poor Sapphire.
They do get at least the idea that it's about them defeating Maxie and Archie, which I actually really like, the idea that it's the humans who are the last ones they have to beat. Like,
well, they point out at one point, because Absol shows up, the disaster Pokemon. Its appearance means that there's a disaster. And they're like, Absol is going to help us. And they're like, well, no, Absol is a creation, is, you know, a signifier of nature, you know, and a force of nature can't stop this disaster because it was man-made. Men create, cause this to happen. Which is cool.
Yeah. And there is a satisfying final fight that happens between them. It would probably.
Cosplay Team in the Thief of Chat brings up a detail that I almost forgot. Freaking Ruby has Celebi just randomly in this fucking.
Well, that's part of where this is getting to. There's some issues that come about because of the conclusion, and one of the biggest ones is that, and this is what I was kind of trying to talk about earlier, but avoided to since we weren't at that far yet. But the big issue I kind of have with Sapphire is that by the end of it, she's just dwarfed by the fact that Ruby's a better battler than she is, so she loses what kind of made her unique. You know, it was about her being someone who treasures battling more. But Ruby's just like, yeah, but because I'm a gym leader's son and because I took a lot of training, I'm just better than you at that.
What if at the end, instead, like, Ruby came across an opponent that he could not defeat?
Yeah,
or Sapphire just came along and picked it up and then defeated and proved that she had surpassed him.
Or if she had a significant moment just showing off her battle prowess. Her most significant contribution outside of being in that final battle is simply the fact that she has a Wailord and a Relicanth, and it's like, this is destiny that you're here.
Which, by the way, that's another thing that really bothers me about her. She does not catch a lot of her Pokemon. She inherits Wailord from her dad. She inherits Tropius from her dad, because they're her two big childhood Pokemon. Obviously, she gets Torchic from her dad, because it's her starter. Does she actually, like, catch anything? Well, she kind of catches Relicanth.
She's already caught Aeron, and then I'm trying to remember what her other. No, she catches Donphan, but Donphan's not really significant. Donphan's kind of forgettable.
Doesn't really do much. So,
but it's just the fact that there's that already kind of undermines her. And then at the end, if you actually read the last volume's, like, preview, it's like, but what about Ruby's mysterious 6 Pokemon? And for a while, they've taken Phoebus out of his, like, collection at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, that's going to be the payoff, is that Phoebus shows back up, evolves into Milotic, and that's the sixth Pokemon that kind of rescues him. And that's what happens. But then after that happens, it doesn't really do anything. He's like, I guess I'll just reveal the sixth Pokemon I never revealed that I had in Celebi! It's like, what the fuck? Why do you have Celebi? It works because they're trying to, like, essentially undo the fact that several characters, major characters, have died as a result of this battle. And it just kind of comes out of nowhere and is just like, I'm not going to change the consequences of what ultimately happened, but I'm basically going to undo, it's like, I'm going to Dragon Ball wish away the deaths, essentially.
Yeah.
And it's like, this would be fine if it was ever hinted at. The only hint that this is something that could happen is that we know that he's from Johto. Beyond that, mm-hmm. It's never like he reached for the Pokeball and was like,
what if I have to use this as my last option? Yeah.
It's just all of a sudden, boom, Celebi. It's like, what the fuck? What? Where? Why? Where the hell did this come from? And that's why it was kind of weird. I was like, why didn't he just have Jirachi? Or have Jirachi show up, because Jirachi's the wish Pokemon, and just wish away. It would have made more sense, but that's why I'm like, I guess they used Jirachi maybe in the later part. It's weird, and it's an awkward stumble in an otherwise very exciting conclusion. But all that said, I still really enjoy the way it ends. There's definitely some issues with the writing. There's some awkward parts, you know, and there's definitely a lot of plot lines that just kind of don't go anywhere. The Elite Four doesn't feel significant. Steven doesn't feel like he has a whole lot to do. Wally feels like he just kind of showed up to get left there. You keep wondering why they keep cutting to Tabby or Gabby and Ty when they haven't been relevant.
Don't do shit. We're here to be the observer characters.
There's things that you're just like, why is this here? But then there's stuff they do really well, like Courtney, as we mentioned, she gets a very huge, prominent role, and there's just almost everything that they allude to does get followed up on. There's this great kind of tease at one point at the end of a chapter where Courtney's battling Ruby, and she says, why don't you join us? It's like the end of the chapter cliffhanger. Cuts back, you finish the fight, all that happens. Later on, he does basically join up with her, kind of as a way to call back to that, not under the same circumstances, but just as a way to address that. And you're like, oh, that is cool. And, you know, Courtney has this big heroic sacrifice. And there's all these things that do come together in a very exciting, climactic way. But there are issues in that there's so many things that have to get paid off that some of them just don't get time to be addressed or just don't feel very significant in the long run, because there's a lot of stuff that has to go into this conclusion. Like, the Regirocks have to come in there, and it's considered that the Elite Four
For like a single chapter.
Yeah, it's like the Elite Four had to gather them, but they don't actually do anything except for, like, presumably stand outside banging on rock walls until they figure out the code. Steven hands over the coat to Wallace, and that actually does... That is cool, because it is a way to pay homage to the fact that Steven stops being champion, gives it to Wallace. Mm-hmm. But there's still just, like, missing parts where you're just, like, you want a little bit more. You want a little bit more context. And it has that awkward taste of Celebi out of nowhere that kind of hurts it a little bit. So it's not as fine of a conclusion, I think, as Gold and Silver had with, you know, Celebi. Mm-hmm. Another Celebi thing, but one that made a lot more sense.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have...
Because it was built up to. The whole plot was centered around getting Celebi so that they could go back in time for the villain's plot and everything.
Yeah. And it doesn't have those moments of, like... crazy cool awesomeness, like in Gold and Silver, where it's like, we're sending all of our Pokemon around Johto to you to help you out. Like, it doesn't
and
have...
all of the Pokedex trainers are gathered here to stop you.
It doesn't have that, but it still, despite that, still feels just as epic. It just doesn't have one of those fuck yeah moments, exactly.
I think a big problem is that the third act starts like halfway into this story.
It's essentially four volumes worth.
One long climax. And yeah, so I definitely agree with you in terms of there is a lot that you wish could be better about this, because the baseline that you have is so good. Such good goddamn protagonists. They're so fun. And then, meh. I do really love this arc, though.
Yes. So. I wish I'd say more, but I realize we're almost already past it.
We're way over time on this. So
we got to wrap this up and start blasting through manga. So
the same thing happened to us that happened to Pokemon Ruby and Sapphire that we've got to rush through.
We got to wrap this shit up. I like Ruby and Sapphire a lot. I had high expectations of this, knowing it was like my favorite gen, and I was kind of hoping for a lot from it. I think it succeeded in reaching those expectations. There are some issues that I think might taint it a little bit. It might be just because I don't remember enough about Gold and Silver to remember some of the issues it had. But overall, I really enjoyed this part. I like the protagonist quite a lot. And I look forward to seeing essentially Leaf Green and Fire Red, like seeing essentially these characters interact with the larger world again, I imagine. I imagine at least there's an Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire out there to enjoy at some point. So I like this a lot. It has flaws, but it's still very fun. I just think this is definitely the part where I'd be like, you need to be a Pokemon fan, I think, to enjoy it at this point. It's probably always been a like requirement, but this is the part that's most like.
This is definitely where it shows up. It's like, wow, there's a whole lot of you better have played the games in order to get what's going on here moments. Yeah. All right, let's just get into the recap portion. We can manga recap. Just go through this. I've already made my thoughts known on the series, so. So we're going to start things off with My Hero Academia, number 126, Open Up World. We open up with Aizawa telling 1A that he actually talked things over with the other teachers, and a lot of them just said, you guys are not going to have work studies for first years. But we will allow agencies with proven track records that offer work studies to take on first years. And Bakugo at first is just like, ha! None of you guys are going to be able to do anything! Actually, we are. Damn it!
Curses.
So we also then see Deku talking with All Might about meeting up with Sir Nighteye, as was suggested to him in the previous chapter by Gran Torino. And Toshinori is like, I've got three reasons for not introducing you to him. First of all, I was one of the people who was opposed to the conference. And I don't think that you guys shouldn't have to do this. Secondly, I want you to wait until you've actually strengthened your shoot style. And third, it'd be really awkward for me. So, after Deku does big, deep bowing, begging Toshinori to reconsider, he's like, okay, well, I'll make sure you get an introduction, but it won't be for me. And that's when we catch up to the present, where we left off at the end of last chapter with Mirio and Deku sitting in with Toshinori. And what Toshinori proposes is, okay, what do you think of Deku? Do you think that maybe he could have you work with Sir Nighteye instead? Because you've been working a lot with them. You've been doing your work study under him. And Mirio says, okay, well, Deku, what kind of hero do you hope to become? And he starts off by sort of doing the thing that he's always done, you know, in terms of looking up to All Might, which is, oh, I want to be the type of hero that will always smile, no matter what kind of trouble anyone's in, I'll be reassuring. But then remembering his past experiences, being injured and worrying his mother, what Bakugo had told him that he admired about All Might. And he says, well, I also want to be strong enough so that no one ever has to worry. A hero who always wins, one who always saves the day. The greatest hero. And Nero's like, well, that's kind of quite the Scattered mission statement, but okay, let's do it.
I love that kind of evolution of Deku's kind of thought process, though, and showing the evolution his character's had. This has been, it's tough to always see it in the pieces individually as it happens, but I think we really have to like eventually sit back and acknowledge just how fantastic Deku's character arc is.
And starting off as this very naive, idealistic kid and realizing the realities of being a hero and understanding what it really takes.
At the same time, defying our expectation for what that kind of character was. It's not as though people, like when you look at Deku, how he was early on, you'd be like, what a naive character. It was kind of dealt with realistically as showing like, hey, you keep getting hurt, you're making your mother worry, all these things, and seeing how it's slowly evolved in him saying, I want to be the greatest hero now. And all that entails.
And Toshinori thinks to himself while he's looking at Mirio, you know, remembering what he talked about with the principal. Oh, yeah, you know, his grades are nothing to write home about, but he's got presence, and wherever he goes, laughter is sure to follow. He might be lacking in achievements, but smiles are never in short supply. A perfect match for your heroic ideals. And Toshinori is kind of thinking to himself, if I hadn't stumbled upon Midoriya, this boy would have been, and he doesn't say it, but he would have probably been the inheritor.
Interesting.
We get a little scene at the dorms, Deku rushing out the door because he's going off for his meeting. He's even going into full cloak so that he runs faster. Todoroki and Bakugo go off for their provisional license course. Bakugo, of course, being a dick to Todoroki about it. And then just kind of a little bit of conversation between some of the students talking about what they're going to do with their day. Kaminari's like, oh, hey, you guys going to go to Momoyao's study party? And they're like, nah, we got plans. I mean, it suddenly cuts in with, who should I fantasize about today?
Good old fucking Midoriya. Or not, Midora. Midora. Whatever his name is, Midora. I'm changing like 8 characters. Good old Luffy.
So, Mirio and Deku arrive at, Sir Night Eye's agency. And, Mirio's like, okay, I should mention, you know, that, Sir is a strict guy. And Deku's like, oh no, I've heard, you know, he's a stoic hero, famous for being strict with himself and with everyone else. The stare of his always is giving me chills, even in video clips. Mirio's like, oh yeah, but, there's also another side to him. He doesn't really show to people. And if you don't want to get turned away at the door, before you're done talking with him today, you've got to make him smile. So, I don't know if you thought of this, but the first thing that popped in my head when they were going through this was, oh, he's King Kai.
Oh, yeah, I vaguely recall that, yeah.
That they, King Kai would force people to make him laugh before he would train them. So they told horrible puns in the dub. So Mira says, yeah, you know, despite his image, or maybe because of it, he's got a lot of respect for humor. I can only get you in the door, and it's up to Sir whether or not he likes you. From here on, you've got to be the one to win him over. He's like, okay, but all right. And Deku asks, he actually asks Mira right out, why are you, you know, helping me out so much? And Mira says, well, you know, I've heard about your goals, and I'm the kind of guy who just butts in whenever someone needs help. That's basic stuff. Maybe he's secretly evil, Chris.
Hey, it still could happen, alright?
It could very well happen.
I've called evil characters before, alright?
No one's that good before. So, we get a very weird scene after this.
Hey, where, look, alright? We've let a lot of fetishes through with Fairy Tail. One Piece gets a couple of them in there, too. One that's never been addressed, though. Very popular, I believe. The tickling fetish. Someone out there just got theirs. Fucking Horikoshi Sensei came through for you guys, alright?
It's the fact that he freaking straps her down onto this board.
That's how you do it, Nick. You don't let them move around. You gotta do it against their will. That's what makes it so hot. According to people on the internet, I don't know.
So, yeah, basically he's put this bubble girl character inside of the tickle hell machine to make her laugh because she wasn't humorous enough when getting her report. How terrifying.
What's so weird, it's not that he's doing that that's awkward to me. It's that he's complaining while she's doing, like, she's laughing. He's like, oh, for goodness sake, must you be so loud? It's like, you're tickling. What are you expecting? That's what they do. Tickling is you uncontrollably laugh.
So Deku and Mirio come in the door and come across this scene. And Mira's like, oh, I guess his sidekick, Bubble Girl, wasn't being funny enough. And Deku's like, okay, this is it. I've got to get stronger. I've got, you know, everyone has put up with me and helped me get this far. And now I've got to open the path for it myself. Humor, though. All right. Nothing but to do it. All to be the top hero. And he contorts his face to make it look like All Might's. And when I first saw this page, I fucking lost it. I was just so unexpected when he pulled, to see Deku's moppy head just like,
trying to imagine how his face becomes like that too, exactly. Since the two universes are essentially usually like quite different from one another.
And everyone is shocked to see him do this, and Deku's like, ah, oh, it's a good thing I've been practicing looking like All Might for years, like the nerd. But he's like, I've got a terrible sense of humor, so if this doesn't do it, then I can't get my work study with Night Eye. And Night Eye just looks at him and is like, are you making fun of All Might?
It's like, shut up!
He's like, well, that didn't work. What a weird fucking chapter this was.
The jury's definitely going to be out on how much I'm going to enjoy Night Eye as a character, Sir Night Eye, I guess. We're gonna have to see
how this unravels in the next couple of chapters, definitely.
Yeah, it's got some weirdness right now, but I can definitely see how it'll still be enjoyable overall. But, it's definitely like an odd kind of tone to set things off with. It definitely can still work out. You know, I usually am not let down by Horikoshi, but yeah, it's an odd character. I'm going to tell you right now, Sir Night Eye didn't make my character MVP of the week.
All right, let's move on to fairy tale.
We have two chapters.
Two chapters.
So luckily, the first chapter is pretty quickly to talk about. 520, Dragon or Demon. So I don't even recall if this was directly brought up, like if this was something that was longly teased to be happening. I know we've been cutting back and forth between, I want to call him Deku, Natsu, being in this kind of like dream memory thing.
Right.
It all has to deal with the fact that he is dying, and he's kind of addressing that it's happening.
And there's the demon seed inside of him, and so in order to, if you kill Xerath, then he will die too, and all that.
Yes. But he also has the dragon seed inside of him as well. So he's talking with Ignil, explaining how when, you know, Ignil's explaining when the dragon seed and the demon seed merge, you'll no longer be able to live as a human. And Natsu starts, like, thinking, like, oh, there's so much I want to do. So Ignil punches him in the head. It's like, no, you listen for once. I'm saying don't let that happen. Choose one. Choose to be a dragon or a demon, which is weird. I'm like, why would he choose the latter at all? Like, that doesn't seem like anything he'd ever
do. He doesn't seem like he would object too strongly to being a dragon.
Yeah, but he says no to that. He's like, I don't want to be either. I'm a human. I'm Natsu Dragnel. And Ignil's like, you picked the right answer. You're cured! And literally, okay, the seeds, figuratively at least, destroy, evaporate, and presumably Natsu is no longer going to be haunted by this demon side of him, and it definitely seems to indicate he is not going to die now should he kill Xerath. It's not entirely clear if that's the case, but it does seem like they cleaned this up very neatly.
Oh, that was easy!
In an extremely quick fashion, like, I thought
makes it easy.
I thought they would at least carry this on to the fight with
Chris. It's fairy tale.
I know, but it's. I mean, you took out the drama that was even going into it.
I know. Isn't it fucking stupid?
The rest of the chapter is just Natsu waking up. Lucy's naked. They try.
Lucy's
to
still naked.
Up as a joke.
Yeah.
Then it's like, oh shit, August. Oh, because Irene was defeated, everything like splatters back to where it was.
Everything's back to normal. Makarov's still dead, but...
Yeah, Makarov's dead, but they're back in town. They're at Lucy's place now. That's the chapter. Then we jump over to chapter 521. I'll address both these chapters as a whole afterwards, which is... Sorry, I'm at the end of the chapter. 521, The Strongest Wizard. And this is basically about how August is ready to throw down. He's going to throw down and face down.
We cut around to all the friggin' 12, like, getting their asses kicked.
Well, I guess the only ones that were still left, like, we see Jacob, he gets defeated by Mira Jane because I guess he couldn't look at her because he'd be like, oh, you're too hot or whatever. They just abruptly end that. And then this annoys the shit out of me, one, because it happened off screen, but two, because this is horse shit. Fucking somehow Elfman and... cat girl sister, whose name I don't want to bother remembering at this moment,
Lusana,
defeated fucking Ajeel, the desert guy. They just beat him. And he just, like, they just said, wait, is he really down? It took both of us to beat him. It's like, how? Elfman, maybe. What did you contribute to this? She's like, I became a cat girl. I put on my cat bikini and fought. And then scratched at him. God damn it.
I used all the sand. You summoned as a litter box.
It's like, that's so gross.
That's someone's fetish, I'm sure.
Yeah. Basically, what happens is the old guy we saw from way back when shows up and is like, this is my grandson. Don't kill him. And they basically war is
awful. Wait a minute, you guys are... And it's like, oh, well, we're family, too. You guys don't look anything alike. Oh, you're one to fucking talk. It's like, yeah. And then Brandis shows up and is like, I've got the Maria shrunk down. Anyway, we're leaving. Bye.
It's basically
like, won't we, baby? Bye.
It's a quick little blurb about, like, war is bad. It's awful. It's no good. But family is important and nonsense and so on. And then all of a sudden, everything starts shaking. And it's because August is getting ready to fight. He's like, so I'm the only one of the 12 still fighting. Fine, prepare yourselves to offer up your flesh and souls to his majesty. For I, as a child of the Empire, shall vanquish the enemy, even if it should cost the souls of yourselves as well. So I guess he's going to kill everybody. But before he can, Gildart shows up. I'm assuming guitar solo.
I mean, who would have expected Gildart would show up when he already showed up?
I know. He tricked you with that. He didn't expect a double Gildart's show up. And he's basically like, I'll distract August. And I'm like, all right, I guess. August better win, but he probably won't. So it leaves Natsu open to run after him, after Zeref, to go to the guild and fight him. But he's like, someone else might get there first. They cut over to Fairy Tail, and it's Zeref. He's like, oh, I never thought you'd be the one to get here first. I was predicting Shalil or Laxus, but this really is a shame. We see it's Gray, and he's all injured and holding onto his rib, and he's like, isn't it about time for you to run along home? See, you're sitting in my spot. And Zeref's like, I'm going to obliterate you into just chunks of nothingness. So that's where we essentially left. Gray's going to fight Zeref for a moment, get the shit kicked out of him, but it kind of makes sense for that to happen. We need some stakes now that Natsu doesn't have impending death anymore. The first chapter that we discussed was really bad. It was way too easy to kind of just solve something that was kind of building to be somewhat interesting of a dilemma for Natsu, with just a choice that doesn't seem like it was really even a thing. Like, it's not like Natsu's struggle with his humanity was an element of his character for even this arc. It's not like he's ever sat there and be like, am I really a demon? Even the moment people thought he may have been evil was actually just him blinded by rage, essentially. So it's dumb that that part was even, like, kind of treated like it was a big deal, like his decision was huge. But the second chapter with the old guy whose name I can't remember, even though I just said it, Gildart's. Gildart's showing up to be like, I'll fight August. I mean, it makes sense. There's not too many people left who are not, like, injured.
On that
fuck.
Tier, yeah.
Yeah, so he kind of has to be one of them, but it's... I'm hoping that that's more of a significant fight than it is, because it's just like, God, at least let the biggest dude of the Spriggan 12 be interesting, at least. The Gray part, fine. It works, you know. It gives Gray a moment to be cool for a moment. I kind of actually like that line about you're sitting in my spot. And
that's pretty badass.
Yeah, and we need a moment that... Gray's going to get this shit pushed in. He has to. And Natsu needs some motivation going into this. But it's just, yeah, I'm not too super excited right now. So, that wraps that up. Let's move along.
Food Wars. The 3-on-3 training continues. We get this cover page on chapter 202, Arianist Training, which I find to be bizarrely, inappropriately sexual.
It's a bit odd, because, like, you could show it's, like, the duality of her back when she was haughty to what she is now. The second image, though, happens to look a little bit too, like, oh, what are you doing back there, you big strong man? And they're both bending over.
I better cut my boobs so that, because I'm so innocent.
Yeah, it's like, it would be more appropriate if the second image was her happy as opposed to, like, cautiously looking behind her. But yeah, they both happen to also be bending over, which doesn't help.
Yeah.
But hey, then again, the guy who draws
it is
food wars, look,
again.
Nick.
Nobody's clothes explode off in this chapter, so they had to get the fan service in somewhere.
Eventually, Steve Mann had to draw a fucking ass to Lost in Space with some chick looking under her butt, all right? It just happens. You draw porn for a living, you need to eventually do it.
Eventually, the former porn artist has to be like, no, you know what? Fuck it.
You can't try to stop me.
You can't. You didn't draw me a scene where I could do this, so I'm just going to make a freaking cover page like you. We cut in to see some of the Council of Ten getting the news from Azami. And, we see, like, you know, Momo, the little girl one, is playing, Go with, the sword guy and kicking his ass, apparently. Azon.
This is interesting because I think this is, like, the first time we've seen this guy, like,
he actually talks.
Do anything. So we actually got our first instance of his personality.
Mm-hmm. Azon snatches the phone and he's like, I'm gonna destroy some of you here, so you should let me participate. And, then Tsukasa is the one actually giving them the news, and Tsukasa's like,
what about this? Tsukasa's like,
I don't know if that's a good idea. I mean, wouldn't it be a pain if you lost?
What if you just suck again and he crushes you? And it's Tsukasa, so you know he's not taunting him per se. He's trying to be, like, earnest in his socially awkward way, but he's loving, like, oh, man, are you sure? Like, what if he creams you
again? And then the glasses girl is like... And then Rindo is like, Tsukasa, you jerk! He can hear you! What are you talking about? Don't you have any sympathy for him? I mean, Aizan got completely trashed by a first-year kid, the poor guy. Think about his feelings before you throw it in his face like that. Aizan's still in the phone.
He's like, stop! Stop! He's already dead!
Fucking hilarious. Oh. Honestly, the highlight of the chapter for me, because, I mean, the rest of it is just everyone cooking weird stuff, and everyone in the train like, what the fuck are they making? Because, of course, everyone on Sensemon's team is, not Sensemon's team, Saiba's team is making all sorts of weird stuff. Saiba is making crepes. Soma is doing something with Chiminjako dried fish, and they're like, what is he doing? And then Irina has this big moment where she's thinking to herself, okay, because she's thinking to herself, I have no idea how these are supposed to come together and what I'm supposed to do. And she's like, no, I have to think back to what I found in Polaris. All the crazy incomprehensible ideas that were bouncing off one another, creating solutions and creating possibilities I never imagined. This is the test that Chef Saiba set before us. So she thinks to herself for a bit. She's like, but she's thinking, but no, but this is, oh, I'm a freaking perfectionist and you're wanting me to do this? All right, fine, I'll do it. And she starts grilling up a steak, along with what they're doing. And everyone's like, oh, this is ridiculous. But you know, all the people who are witnessing it are like, she's doing something so unorthodox. But all the teachers are like, ah, but this is a big first for her. The first time that she's truly had to train. And we do get this really cool two-page spread of all the chefs in the kitchen together. It feels like they're really rushing and working together to get something accomplished. There's a, you know, a bit in the middle with Aldini handing off a tray to Megumi while they're working. It's a cool looking scene. And at the end of it, Sentamon declares the time is up and they're going to present their dishes. They're different versions of the food, which do look very, very different from each other.
Yes, there's a definitely going to be a big contrast between the two dishes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is sort of one of those chapters where we can't really say much since we don't know enough about food preparation to be like, holy shit, Nick, do you know that's definitely the Forgeon style of braiding ham or whatever they just did.
Braiding, I don't know. Ham.
I had to think of a verb and a food, Nick. I don't know what happened. Braiding ham. It's what happened. So it's tough for us to comment on it. It's more so I find an interest in them kind of like they're still being very vague about mm-hmm. how many people are actually going to be competing. So
yeah.
It's interesting to see, but it's also one of those things like I wonder what they're going to do. I do like Aizan kind of being like, or Aizan rather being like, let's just show us, like hit him with a show of strength. I'm wondering if they're just going to go at them with the full council.
Yeah, they could very well be just like, you have to defeat the entire council of 10.
It would be really weird.
With however many students you have.
Yeah, well, I guess it'd be the Council of Nine since Aaron has still
right, tendency. Right.
But it still would be like, huh, I wonder how they're going to do that essentially. Because it would be weird to have the heroes beat the entire council. Like, you lose out on
maybe,
all those.
Maybe it's like, you have to take on, you know, all of our underlings first in order to prove that you can go up against us or something.
Yeah, it's definitely a very interesting prospect. I'm really hoping, like, next week we finally get all the details. Like, I'm really at a point of, like, I want to know what actually is happening.
And so that's really being built up that, yeah, Azami's got some way of addressing this challenge that's been laid out before him.
Exactly.
So let's move on to our jump starts. First off, U19, or Under 19, which is our new series. Don't really know exactly what's going on yet, because some details have been saved for what's going on. There are hints of some of what this is going to be about, and we get this very bizarre setting. But essentially, it seems like it's going to be a manga take on Codename Kids Next Door, which I'm totally cool with because that was an awesome cartoon. And what we get is that kids in this world are very much like oppressed by grown-ups. there was this uprising of the grown-up party, 20, which we get a t-shirt.
Aren't all parties grown-up parties? It's like the tea party juniors.
I like how ridiculously juvenile the naming is, though. It's like, the grown-up party. Like, the kids only, no adults allowed party. the teacher is explaining to these kids that, oh yeah, the grown-up party basically fixed everything. They rebuilt this country. There was apparently this education mandate that utterly failed. And so that is why the grown-up party rose to power, and our leader, Yamato Shiki, and the many respectable grown-ups that serve under him now educate all you kids. And corporal punishment is now legal, and that is why this country is great. I mean, that's essentially what he sums it up with, is we can do whatever you want to you kids and are preparing for adulthood, and that's why this country is great.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty... It's like being in Catholic school all over again. I had a teacher who bragged about that to us. He's like, you know, we can still beat you. We don't, but we still can. Stop bragging about this.
And, you know, the teacher is, you know, getting on them for all sorts of stuff. You know, like, he scolds one kid for being left-handed. He rips open a girl's pencil case because she's got a tiny little star charm accessory on it. Then the main character, Eiji Kudo, he likes sewing. And they're like, this is something that women do. You know, men do boy sewing. No, it's unnecessary for your studies. And he, like, snaps his sewing needle in half. And Eiji gets this badass ? Moment where he goes, why can't boys sew? Lots of men work in the garment industry.
It's weird because it's almost treated as a joke by the teacher as well. The teacher's like, yeah, good for you for thinking that, like, being a bum is a divine opportunity. Nice job. Way to be open-minded. Great job being woke, young man.
Well, he's like, he's just rebelling against the guy. He's like, you know, you're being really distracting. You ripped apart her pencil case and you're interrupting the class to scold us for all these little things. And he punches him in the fucking nose. He's like, hey, come on. Corporal punishment is now permitted by law, so we should be gross about this. And you should get out of here. Go out in the hallway and cool off. And that'll let you get educated. And he's like, that's fucking stupid. Who can learn while they're standing out in the hall? And he's like, you know, that's actually a good point. Eiji goes on this big thing. Oh, actually, the thing that really gets into him, because he was like, okay, I'll reiterate to you guys. Remember, adults are divided up into different categories. You A, B, C, D. I'm rank A because I was a teacher before the party came to power. And rank D, you're on your way to being that, a no-good grown-up. And Eiji's like, well, you know what? My father's rank D, and yeah, he's got a harder job than you, but it's still an important job that supports this town, and he and my mother live a happy life together, and I don't see anything wrong with that. He's like, that's such a beautiful sentiment that you are discriminatory like that. It's really weird the way that the characters just act in this bizarre setting that's been come with for them. And I'm gonna try and rush through this because there's so many details that you could focus on, so many different things that come up. But essentially, there's this rumor going around that people unlock, like, special psychic abilities with their libido, and that there is a rebellious group that information from kids about.
One moment they're like, it's going to be a series about overcoming, like, oppressive leadership in schools. And the next moment, it's like, and a crazy power battle series with awesome power things. You're like, mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And also, there is a romantic comedy between old childhood friends because Eiji's got a crush on Tsukino, who's kind of an airhead.
It's just sort of like, okay.
There's a bit where she's like, kind of, you know, helping out the teacher in order to suck up to him, and he's like, well, life would be so much easier if I had more students like you. And Tsuki is like, no, it's because I'm not very smart, so I need to rack up points this way, and I hope that gets reflected on my evaluation. He's like, I'm glad you're so upfront about it.
Thank you.
And we get a good chunk of the chapter dedicated to building on this relationship that Eiji and Tsukino have, that it's clear that they both like each other. But, you know, they're just childhood friends at this point. We also get a sweet moment when Eiji gets home and his dad comes home from work. You see a bit of the home life that they have together where they're obviously, they don't lead an easy life, but his parents are actually happy together. There's, you know, just a cute moment of them joking around. Even his father is like, you know what? The grown-up party actually did kind of fix some stuff. Like, I could not get a job before they came along. And, you know, there's, you know, no child left behind now with this policy of theirs. And so everyone has guaranteed employment and a guaranteed home under them. It's just that they, you know, classism is bad.
I think we might need to just cut this really short and just finish up here.
And essentially what happens is the adults the next day announce, we've got a new way of just figuring out what ranks you guys belong in. Genetic screening. And Eiji does not bother learning what his rank is. He's like, it doesn't fucking matter. But we see that Tsukino has rank triple S. And it's like, oh, isn't that great? But the adults come along and are like, you're exactly what we're looking for. And decide to take her away. And she's forced to transfer schools, which... of course, has a big effect on Eiji, and you see that something inside of him might be starting to awaken. So I'm very curious about this series. We still don't really know exactly what kind of series it's going to be yet. Obviously, it's got a bizarre sci-fi setting, which I'm interested in learning more about. But I don't know, we'll see.
Yeah, I'm really juried out on this one. Maybe the second chapter kind of ties it all together. It's got great art, interesting kind of lead power, but I'm still very much like, I don't know what this is.
We never learn. We learn what the two girls' goals in life actually are. Let's see. Literature, who wants to be a scientist girl, wants to study the stars because her mother died and she wants to find her mother's star, which is very sweet and is an actual career goal. And Ogata wants to learn how to read people in order to be a better gamer, which doesn't seem nearly as, like, long-term
as the other girls. I mean, to be fair, the first one's also like, I mean, that's a lot of work to find your mother's star. Like, once you find it, aren't you done, essentially?
At least that's a career, though.
At least, yeah, and also there's an emotion behind it. With this one, it's just like, if I could be better at reading,
I want to be able to read people's poker faces so that I can beat them at games.
It's like, what?
It's just...
definitely like a...
It's very strange. I thought it was like, oh, we're going to learn something sweet about both of them. Well, we learned something sweet about one of them.
Yeah, it's in a way, we kind of are.
This is a good one. Promised Neverland, Chapter 26, I Want to Live. Norman, we learned, was getting shipped out. And he's getting shipped out tomorrow. And there's nothing really that they can do about it at this point, because Emma's leg is broken, and so they're not going to try and escape. Everyone starts freaking out. Ray tries to think about what they're going to do, and he's like, we have to change our plans, because she's taking our ropes away, Emma's crippled at this point, and okay, we've got to just prioritize Norman. Because we've got to make sure that he can survive, and that's our time limit, if we can make sure that he gets out. But he is also thinking, like, well, shit, if Norman escapes, then they might heighten security. We could only have one escape chance. And, you know, Norman is considering that in terms of, that's why Emma wanted everyone to escape together, because they've got only one chance to get out. If we escape, the other kids will be left behind and they're not going to be able to get out. Also, we get bizarrely, like, sympathetic flashbacks to Crone.
Yeah, they're everyone like, God, remember when Crone was just the best? She's always smiling, doing things for us. She was so great, wasn't she? It's like, you know, she was trying to fuck all of you over, right? Like, it really...
Remember when she terrified us by chasing us down to play tag? we get a bit with Norman just, you know, looking over Emma while she's stuck in her hospital bed, essentially. And she thinks to herself, my leg that hurt so much before doesn't hurt now, because she can just imagine, you know, Norman being taken away and finding his corpse with the flower sticking out of it. And she's like, what am I going to do? Because he's going to die. And she, you know, just desperately cling on to his hand, and she's getting increasingly desperate looks on her face while she thinks about him. And Norman starts to feel guilty because, you know, previously he was like, I want to, you know, make him happy. I want to save everyone in order to do what she wanted to do. And now all I can think of is that I want to live. I want to survive this. and he collapses onto his knees while he's off by himself thinking about it. But Emma and Ray have already shifted their priorities. Their friend is in danger, and they're going to save him. That's what they've decided on. Norman has more time to think to himself while he's getting a drink, and he's like, okay, if I skip alone, everyone's going to die. I'm the only one who's going to be able to get out, so there's only one thing I have to do. I mean, I've only got one day to figure this out. I'm going to make sure things don't go the way the mom wants them to. I'm going to destroy her plan, and I will use this life to the fullest until the end and successfully help everyone escape. He goes back into Emma's room. Ray is there to talk with him. We're not going to let you die. We're going to make sure you escape by yourself tomorrow afternoon. And I'm sure that plan is going to go exactly as planned.
Flawlessly, Nick. This thing's going to go flawlessly.
It's a good chapter because, it shows what the kids do when they're confronted with their first really big setback and their first really big failure. Mm-hmm. Their plan to scout the outside world completely failed. They did not get anything done that they wanted to. And things are even worse for them now.
Yep.
So how they react to that is really cool. And I like how they all react in different ways.
Yes. You do get, a wide range. And it's nice seeing Ray also, showing some real, affection for Norman. He's kind of unclear exactly how much he did, but this definitely kind of firmly established, no, he cares about both of them kind of at least somewhat equally. So seeing that kind of distraughtness on them is refreshing.
Yep. I like how, Emma is almost ready to sink into despair. Ray just immediately just starts working on the next plan, just more desperately this time. And Norman really has to kind of come to grips with his own flaw of, I can be kind of selfish, I do have this sort of selfish sense of self-preservation, and they all confront it and essentially reach the same conclusion of, I must prioritize helping my friend despite this. So,
yeah.
All right, Black Clover, page 97, it's nothing. Last time, the Witch Queen unlocked Asta's hidden abilities, and we see him sinking into a void, and he thinks about Yuno. Yuno showed up!
Well, of course he is. He's on the cover page, Nick.
He's on the cover page.
He'd obviously show up if he's on the cover page.
And he is confronted by this large black entity, It's played for laughs. Because Asta has a big freak out over. He's like, what are you?
For as weird as that might be, I would be angry if Black Clover did anything else. Because Black Clover has almost always been, whenever something dramatic would happen, Asta is still going to respond to it as Asta would. And he does just so.
It's one of those things where it's like, this is why I made the John Cena comparisons. For Asta to do anything other than be himself would not be true to this series and to his character. I can't help that I don't like it. So Asta just kind of confronts this demon head on, and he's like, I'm going to take control of your body so that I can, live in the real world now. And Asta's like, no, you're not. I'm going to beat that guy with the power I've already got. No, let me take control of your mind, and that way, I'll win for it. No, you can't underestimate me. You shouldn't underestimate dwarfs. Is Asta really that short?
I don't think he's that short.
They keep on making a thing about how short he is, but it's kind of hard to tell because he's so goddamn jacked. And Asta just kind of jumps on the demon's arm as it tries to claw him, and then runs up its arm, and it looks like he's going to punch it in the face because he refuses to give up. We cut back to the real world. Black energy is flowing over his entire right arm. It's extending into a wing over his shoulder. It's painting half of his hair black. And of course, Lodge is like, what the hell's going on here? And the Witch Queen starts to monologue saying, I thought he had lost consciousness, but he seems to have actually managed to control it. Anti-magic energy flows constantly through the Demon Slayer sword, and as a result, no one should be able to wield it. But you are magicless, and that power flows through you. You've been unconsciously emitting and shutting off that power. Using the power of my blood, which I transfused during your treatment, I accelerated the flow of power, and I've just removed the limits on its output. As a result, the anti-magic power will become a raging torrent, and you will become its vessel. Okay, makes sense. And she says, I assumed you were one of their kin, but I was wrong. You're simply defective. A sudden mutation kept mana from dwelling in you. But because of that, you were able to wield that sword. You aren't special or anything like it, but that is what makes you special. And Vladros lashes out in anger at Asta, launches a huge wave of energy at him, and Asta gets this admittedly pretty cool scene where he just darts straight through the blast, cutting straight through the middle of it as he rushes in. And absolutely nothing is affecting him because anti-magic is flowing through him and completely repelling and also repelling it away from him while also drawing it in towards its source. And Ladras just strikes straight through the blast, and Ladras is like, why are you doing this? And Asta says, everybody help boost me up, and that makes me stronger. And he cuts through Ladras' shoulder in a big two-page spread to end the chapter.
The visual of him, like, ripping through the blast is extremely well done. Like, it's a very cool visual that definitely took a lot of precision to get that to look the way it did and look as cool as it did. I'm not entirely sold on this demon thing yet. I'm assuming
You're the one who's got a problem with Asta. Okay.
I know. It's going to come in circles. It's very much, though, it feels like the Natsu thing that just happened, where it's just like, I've got this demon that's going to control me, but I'm going to control you! It's like, oh. Like, his first time this happens, he's like, I'm stronger than the demon.
Now, I kind of have the same problem, but for a different approach to it, which is, I think that it is one thing to say, like, okay, he's got this inner demon thing. And I think it would be wrong to say he's got this inner demon and, oh, it doesn't control him? What the fuck? Why can't it be like, you know, the QB or whatever? But it's like, well, no, because one of the things that we kind of crapped on Black Clover early on was, well, he's just Naruto. But this is a different take on that, which is, okay, he had his, you know, inner hollow or his inner demon or whatever. And instead of, oh, he went berserk, you know, the way Natsu did recently. So many different examples through so much of shonen manga where the protagonist has this dark thing inside them that takes them over and they have to learn to control it. Instead, Asta takes it over immediately, and that's different. The only problem I have with it in terms of an idea is, well, if it doesn't affect him in, you know, externally at all, what's the point of it?
Yeah,
why is it there to begin with? Which, I'm willing to put that aside for now because we know that it is inside him and we don't know what's going to happen in the future. Now, we know this element is confirmed to exist as part of Asta's character, and there is the potential that some stuff could be done with it. So just because it didn't take him over at the very start doesn't mean that nothing is going to be done with it.
Yes. It's very much a lot of room to still play with here. It's just, as a moment, I wasn't crazy sold on it.
Okay.
Right, Ruby?
So let's do 5 seconds of Ruby.
I guess it's not the last chapter, but no one seems to have any fucking clue what happens
after
this.
No one knows when this is actually going to end. It said to be continued.
It said to be continued, but
on that last panel.
There's no chapter 15 in Japan. There was, like, an announcement that it was ending at chapter 14, but
apparently there was, like, a teaser that it might continue. And this story is obviously done. The one that they were just telling. Is there going to be another one?
I have no idea. There's apparently a girl who's a plane. I don't fucking get it. Like, they're fighting the snake thing. Ruby and their team are, like, super good, and they do some combo attack, and they kill it, and they've won. And Ruby's like, I want to be a huntress. And then there's, like, a bunch of teases to a bunch of other stuff. And then there's a bunch of characters we haven't met talking that you wouldn't know unless you watched the series. And then the Ruby characters, like, leap into fucking action, and then it says to be continued. So I don't even know. I guess this is the most coherent and progressive chapter of Ruby, so there's that.
Well, we see some of the stuff that they're actually doing together, like we see them actually putting their plan into action, we see the different members of Ruby actually doing stuff, we see Weiss and Ruby do a team-up attack in order to penetrate the monster's hide so that they can actually get to it. And then all of them rush in together. We see a bit more of a coherent Ruby backstory bit in her flashback. But yeah, it's just like, well, This would have been a whole lot better if, you know, those first 9 chapters had been spent on, you know,
hadn't been weird and a waste of time.
It's done, I guess.
Why the fuck is this girl an airplane? What the fuck is this?
I'm not going to question anything.
All right. One Piece.
One Piece. That's okay. Chapter 855, Glurgle.
Glurgle Snorp.
That's the chapter title.
All right.
So apparently that guy that Sanji kicked the shit out of in the last chapter is actually a pretty powerful member of the Big Mom Pirates. He's got a 105.5 million berry bounty.
It's large, but I think it's just supposed to
it's
be.
It's not excessively large.
It's not excessively large, and I note that he's just a bishop. Like, he's not a member of the Big Mom family. He's just a member of the pirate crew.
Yeah. And he is known as Bobbin the Disposer. When you see him kind of sway back and forth as he gets up, he does actually look pretty creepy, honestly, with the big grin behind the face mask going back and forth. And he vows that he's going to actually take care of Sanji. And in fact, the other guards are going to get into action, and as he sways back and forth, he puts them to sleep so that he can take on Sanji himself. So this is such a surprising chapter. We were thinking last week, how are they going to get Brook out of that situation where, you know, Mom's got him just at her side at all times. We thought, well, maybe they'll use the wedding as the chance to snatch him away. No. Instead, what we get...
Sorry, this... Just continue.
It's so fucking silly. So they go into Mom's room while she's sleeping, and it just... giant snot bubbles for everyone in the room. Mom, her thundercloud, her son... her hat, Brooke, just all... and they're like, we've got to get Brooke away safely. And Brulee's like, Mama, wake up! And they're like, shut up! And every time one of them steps through the mirror to try and save Brooke, she catches a glimpse of them, thinks they're a fly, and swats at them in her sleep. And causes this huge, massive explosion, which causes Brooke to go, oh, what was that? Oh, it's just a fly.
I do love that. What was that? Oh, it's just a fly. It's like, why are you like doing this too?
And Prometheus and Napoleon are all just jumping into action. We see Napoleon can sprout a giant sword from his hat head. they're just wrecking the room every time there is the smallest disturbance. And eventually, the Straw Hats who are there are just like, okay, we made up a dummy to look like Brooke. Or they're like, okay, attempt number one, and Chopper sneaks in with the dummy and just like, at you! And it's like, constantly, attempt after attempt, they're just trying to sneak in, failing and failing, for the stupidest fucking reasons. Mom blows her snot bubble so large it nearly catches Carrot. Pedro tries to get in there, and Mom just rolls over and stops him. And eventually, Nami's just like, okay, fuck it, I'm doing it. and so they manage to snatch Brooke away, get him into the mirror world, and it's like, Brooke, it's me! And Brooke's like, a ghost! It's so fucking goofy. And that wakes up Mom too. And they get into the mirror world finally safely, and Mom still just like falls back asleep immediately. It's the most unexpected way that they could have saved Brooke. It's so goofy and stupid, and I love it.
It's some ridiculous shit.
It's like, we briefly just, like, for about 5 minutes, cut into a Tom and Jerry cartoon or something.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay, so we cut over to where Sanji is, and essentially he's just following the bodies that Luffy has left in his wake, trying to track him down. And we see him just shoving people aside, like, come on, Luffy, where are you? Before we cut back to Brook and everybody else. And everyone, and he realizes, oh, it's you guys, of course. And Pedro's, they're going over, oh, yeah, you know, Pedro says, I should have realized when I saw the security that it would have been impossible to get a copy of the Roppongi glyph, so I'm sorry that I put you in danger like that. And Brook's like, oh, no, it was because of your idea in order to do this for the sake of our crew that we had this opportunity. And if we had attempted to steal Big Mom's Pond Glyph on any other occasion, there would have been no way to avoid an all-out pirate war. So, here's your copy. He just pops open his skull and gives them a copy of it. Like, wait, what?
Say what now?
I love the reactions that we get with Nami and Kara and Chopper. Just like, duh!
All the same eye, like, what is you?
And yeah, he's got these just massive blueprints, essentially, that he folded up really small inside of his skull because there are these massive pieces of canvas that he managed to fit inside of his head. So like, wow, you got this. I can't believe it. And it's like, yeah, I can't believe you managed to do this. And Brooke's like, yeah. And now he's like, oh, Brooke, this is amazing. I can't believe this. And Brooke's like, well, if you're that grateful, then maybe I've earned a glimpse of your pet. Brooke! Breaks his fucking face apart with the force of her punch.
I like that it was apparent he's still in the middle of saying it, so he's like, Panthers!
And Chopper is like, alright, we've achieved one of our main goals, now we've just got to get Sanji and get out of here. And we cut over to Sanji, who manages to locate Luffy from the massive sound of the gurgle of his stomach. Which is where we get our chapter title, Luffy's fucking stomach gurgling.
Blurgle.
And he comes across his friend and he sees him. He's freaking emaciated from not having eaten in so long. And Sanji just smiles because he's found him.
I like the smile a lot. The smile is, like, nice to see.
Yeah. And you kept your promise, Luffy, and you didn't just like you, so. So, a really fun chapter all around. Yes. Progression to the plot, with just completely unexpected slapstick humor. Really a lot of fun.
It definitely a great little chapter there.
So, with that said, we really had to tear through the recap. I think that we managed to finish it in right around an hour. But I guess we are going to have to name our favorites. I don't know, why don't you go first?
This is a really tough week for me because nothing really stood out. Like, nothing was really, like, outright the best. I'm probably just going to give it to One Piece for my chapter of the week. It's not that I thought this chapter One Piece was amazing. It's funny. It's good, but it didn't blow me away. But nothing else was really significant. And this was at least nice to finally get, like, oh, here, Brook has his moment. He turns out he did it. He fucking nailed, like, a huge coup, essentially.
Right. I mean, a lot of the chapters we had this week were, okay, well, let's kind of wait and see where this goes. Food Wars, we essentially got a little bit more of what we got last week, along with some insight into what the council's got going on, including a really funny joke. My Hero Academy is like, okay, well, let's see how things go with this for Night Eye, because can't really draw conclusions off of just this chapter. Promised Neverland was everyone thinking like, okay, well, we've got to pick ourselves back up. And it was good to see the character building in that. But again, it's like, okay, well, this is a little bit of a rest, a little bit of a break in between all the action that we've gotten from Crone dying and Emma getting her leg broken. So this is not a standout chapter for it. So I totally get you, what you mean with that. And I'm going to agree with your pick on One Piece. I think that, honestly, I wouldn't really disagree with almost any selection, I don't think, this week, though.
They're all perfectly fine, just nothing stellar.
And I'm going to make my character MVP Brook. I don't usually like to go for the same thing for the same reasons, but it did feel definitely like, oh, Brook accomplished this big thing. And then, you know, brought home with contributing multiple really funny moments to the sequence of the rescue, and then when he's just like, oh, back to normal, it's like, oh, show me your panties, and the execution of that one slapstick moment, really good.
I'm gonna give it to Burke as well. I was actually a little bit, not disappointed, but I was a little bit wanting from the moment with Burke. I was kind of hoping for the art to portray it as something a little bit bigger, like a full page spread or something, to be like, wow, holy crap, look at what he did.
He opens his head up in this big, in a bigger panel or something.
Yeah, or just something like, it's just like something to make it feel as huge as it was.
It's not like, dedicate more space to like him, like unrolling the copy.
Or just like the art carrying across how monumental an event it was. Mm-hmm. It's not as though this is bad or anything like that. I'm not saying that. And I'm still giving it to Brooke. I still think it's a really cool moment for a band.
Seems to be kind of the theme of this episode was, I really liked it. I wish that there had been more.
Yeah, I wish it had been a little bit better executed or whatever.
One Piece was the choice for our audience poll this week. So that is going to do it, everyone, for this freaking jam-packed episode of Weekly Manga Recap. We hope you enjoyed. If you want to check out more, then be sure to follow us. You can follow us on social media at YRoller of Time, at RollerT, and the podcast official Twitter account is at WMR Podcast, and we'll let you know when we are going to start the show. Normally, we do it Wednesdays at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. On hitbox.tv/RollerT and twitch.tv/RollerT, but sometimes we do need to start a little bit earlier or later, or even do it on a different day. So follow us on those accounts so that you know when we're going to do it. Check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com, as well as on iTunes and on our YouTube channel. Be sure to subscribe, leave a comment, leave a rating, especially on iTunes, so you can help us beat the woodworking podcast in the hobby section and triumph over them.
Special thank you to Helen Hill, who left a 5-star review, says, a wonderful podcast where you don't even have to know about half the tangents they go on to have a good time. Thank you very much, Helen. It is greatly, greatly appreciated. I'm glad you enjoy the show. Thank you for listening.
If you want to provide feedback, ask us questions for us to answer in a Q&A episode, or just suggest future manga for us to review on our show, then you can send all that stuff to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. Special thanks also go out to all of our patron supporters, Patreon. Our Patreon supporters, shut up. Your support allows us to create all sorts of content for you guys to enjoy. We just did the Q&A episode a couple of days ago.
Yes.
And we'll have more coming out soon.
Yes, and special thanks go to Corey Riley and Frozen Courtroom, who are our two newest patrons. Thank you both very much. I'm glad you are enjoying the content. I hope we are a worthy investment for you, and fist bump for awesomeness. Thank you very much, guys. It's greatly appreciated.
And of course, the guys who help make the podcast what it is visually. We got Infamous Plan, who makes frames for our show. And of course, Steve Man, who managed to draw Sapphire without accentuating any of her naughties, which honestly is more than could be said for Adventure. She was naked a lot in this series, now that I think about it.
To be fair, I feel like they didn't dwell on it too much. I mean, there's almost always a panel of it, but I guess it's because she's 11, they couldn't give her too many curves.
No.
But I will note, I don't know this for certain, but I know Steve Mann has two versions of the title card on there.
No.
And one of them is blocked behind the you had to be the dollar patron on it. So I couldn't see it on the WMR account, so I'll have to check later. There may still be a slutty one. I don't know.
You can check out his artwork on his Patreon, where you can see most of the title cards for absolutely free. And also, you can find them in a bunch of different places. Neurotic Fanboy, I Draw Boobs at Tumblr, all sorts of different places. So, thanks. And Chris, what are we doing next?
So, we mentioned before, we've been doing this poll. It's still actually up. I'm not going to take it down until probably we decide on all of them. But we're adding new series to the recap because we reached a certain milestone on Patreon. We're going to be adding new series into the recap, and one of the elements that kind of goes into that is we need to catch up on those series. So I figure the best way to do that is for us to take it on as a recommendation. So this is a series that we're going to be adding into the recap proper. It's going to be becoming a permanent part of the regular recap. Both of us will be discussing it. We're just first going to be giving it a recommendation review, basically, and that is something technically rejoining the show, which is going to be Seven Deadly Sins.
You fucking asshole.
So, we're going to be taking a look at Seven Deadly Sins next, so that we can
All right, next recommendation we're taking is Hajime no Ippo.
Seven Deadly Sins is not that long.
It's not. It has nothing to do with the length. It has to do with the fact that you've read it already.
I've read part of it. I've missed like a year and a half of it.
Oh, year and a half.
That's like half the series. I'm outraged, Nick. I'm almost as outraged as the Sizor thing. That's still pissing me off.
Oh, that's gonna do it, folks.
Yeah. All right, that's good. Bye.
For this time, assuming that we don't have a tremendous falling out over the Seven Deadly Sins debacle.
It's bubble fruit all over again. Nick and I stopped talking to one another. Oh, Nick, we know what we should do. We should end the podcast like the XFL documentary, where like the two of us are having dinner and we awkwardly start teasing to something that we're like, what would it be like if we brought back Botch Snap again, Nick? You're like, oh, I don't know. That could really hit the landscape big. And I'm like, to the future, then. We both hold up wine glasses like we're evil villains as text appears above us that's like, Nick, still can't... Greg is still balding slowly. Chris, still not very attractive. Can't get a girlfriend. I'm like, hey, both of these are mean. Who wrote this? Hey, <it's> a... Mike calls me a wanker. Was this infamous? Is he getting his revenge?
Still not recognizing that M-Zero was the greatest series ever.
The infamous planet. Oh my god. Fuck, got us.
Wait, damn it, I burned myself.